Race to the Floor from Chevelle, our number one song for 13 straight weeks. That's it for us.
If you missed any part of the chart, get caught up at thesideshowcountdown.com and download the iHeartRadio app so you can listen to us no matter where you are.
We'll be back next week, freaks. I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
See ya.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much, and welcome, everybody.
Peter, hello.
Hi. Now, you actually made me very sad telling me this news. Hi, everybody. Peter Werby, Julene Jordan with you. And I just got some news. Michael Davis, the bass player for the MC5, and most of you in Detroit know who the MC5 was, and probably lots of you around the country and around the world do. But he just passed away, an old friend, a great bass player, one of these, what do they always call the MC5, a seminal rock group. In other words, created kind of the style and the musical, I don't know.
I hated to, I figured you,
you
were
told me 30 seconds
before airtime. I really figured you know.
Okay, let's, maybe we'll see. There we go. Let's start it again.
Okay.
Hey, everybody. It's Night Call, another Sunday in the Motor City. Me and Julene Jordan taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Join us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/nightcall. Sarah has the night off, so Athena will be taking your phone calls.
Yes.
Yeah, we want to get you on the air. Please do it. And Athena, right now, even working on the podcast, which will be on the air tomorrow at noon. And we've really hit it, haven't we?
What do you mean?
We've got the podcast at noon. I mean, we're having so many technical difficulties.
I know. Well, let's not jinx ourselves.
Don't talk about a no-hitter.
Jeez.
Let's talk about sex.
What?
Let's talk about...
So soon? So early in the show?
Mitt Romney. Why don't all these politicians, particularly this whole bunch of Republican candidates, none of them use their full legal name?
Yeah, well, it's Mitt
and Newt and Ron and who are we forgetting here? Oh, and Rick.
Oh, well, don't forget Rick. He's been in the news a lot this
week. Yeah, we gotta talk about him. But imagine that. It would be Willard Romney, Ronald Paul.
Right.
Who knows? Maybe some of you Pauloids could tell. Is that his legal name? Maybe sometimes some people are just Ron.
Yeah.
And so Newton Gingrich. And who are we missing? Newton. Yeah.
And Richard.
We said and Richard Santorum. Yeah, but, you know, you got to remember Bill and Jimmy, the Democrats.
Why did he call himself Dick? I don't know.
We'll call him that.
Yeah, because, yeah.
Yeah.
It fits.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. I just don't even know what to say about these guys and how.
Well, you mean just in the last week alone?
Yeah, I mean, how are these Republican politicians, I mean, the Democrats haven't even had a shot at it. These Republican politicians are just twisting our whatever we got.
Well, you know, not so ours, but.
Well, all of ours, yeah. Just being in the world. I mean, you know, they're twisting one thing for men, another thing for women.
Yeah, well, and, they change their story every day to fit the audience or just what they can get more votes out of that particular day.
Well, I wouldn't even mind that.
No,
I mean,
but they're doing it.
Have you seen
it real evil-like.
Have you seen these commercials? I mean, for Richard Santorum and Willard Romney?
Oh, I saw a Santorum one.
Yeah. I mean, what they each accuse the other of is true.
Like we've been saying all along.
Absolutely. And now this big thing about that Santorum saying on Sunday that he condemned what he called President Barack Obama's worldview that, quote, elevates the earth above man.
I mean, this
what
guy.
What is this guy? What planet is he? He's talking about Earth. He's not from planet Earth.
I know. They really know how to beef up something, beef up a lie.
And then he said Obama's agenda is based on, quote, some phony theology, not a theology based on the Bible. I would hope not.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing.
I mean, we're talking public policy here, folks.
This is not the, not, well, this one really struck me most as far as that Santorum, Google it, had this week, because he's saying that Obama's not the right kind of Christian because he's not a radical nutbag.
Yeah, well, you know what? We shouldn't even know what any of these people's religion are.
I agree.
Should I do it? I hate to do it again. I just got a new constitution in the mail.
It's shiny and red.
And red this time. Was blue last time, so they're not playing any favorites. But this comes from the ACLU, and I've read this any number of times. Talked to the senators and representatives before mentioned, and the members of the several state legislators and all the folks. Both of the United States and of the several states shall be bound by oath, which means you swear to God, or affirmation.
Okay,
so they're recognizing that you can have a secular affirmation upon entering office to support this Constitution. That's what you have to swear or affirm. But no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States.
Yeah, in the Republican Party, that it seems to be one of the big tests. How religious are you?
And why does Obama say, well, I'm a Christian, and they show all these things? I mean, do you really
National
think...
Prayer Day.
Yeah, do you think any of these politicians are really authentically... Maybe Santorum, but the rest of them, come on.
I couldn't say, but they're just using it for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
They're using it to get elected to office, which is such a slimy move.
The people I know that, I don't know if you'd say they use religion, they're motivated by the religious beliefs for peace and love and tolerance and social justice.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't think they're in the majority.
First Amendment. I agree.
First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. So why in the world, and I know what the second part of it says too, why in the world are we being subjected to this stuff that comes,
onslaught.
Yeah, comes out of the Middle Ages. I mean, what century is this?
Yeah, and it just keeps going backwards
every
day.
I mean, and the stuff about contraception, remember when it, I mean, that's how far these people have pushed this, mostly guys. But there was this crazy woman, this Republican state legislator, thank you, in New Hampshire, that she said birth control pills cause cancer in men. She's those chemicals leech.
It's unbelievable. I mean, this chick's crazy.
Yeah, well, a lot of them are. Birth control pills actually help prevent cancer in women, though. I mean,
it does a lot of different things.
Yeah, yeah. And they're used
for birth and pregnancy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And so, yeah, so the right wing's going after my uterus all over again. I had to endure it all week, and I can't tell you how many times I had to say, U.S., get out of my uterus.
And
it was a very, very rough week for my uterus.
Well, it was. I mean, why don't they just get out of our lives? Remember I told you during the 19th century that all these labor activists used to refer to these religious people as the God pests, like P-E-S-T-S.
Oh, yeah, yes.
Because they are always... And I mean, what's that? Isn't this religious song? He knows when you are sleeping. He knows when
That's
you're
Santa
awake.
Claus.
You sure? He knows when you are been good or bad, so be good for.
That's.
You sure? That's not God?
Ho, ho, ho.
Are you sure?
Yes.
That's Santa Claus?
Yes.
Why do we have all these people that are always looking over our damn shoulder?
I don't know.
You know?
And they're trying to get into office to control us even more, other than just teasing us controlling us.
Well, some religious groups are equating some contraceptives with abortion. I mean, this is now they're talking about IUDs and the morning after pill and all of that. And they're abortifacients, is that how you say it, or abortifacients? Because they say they can act to prevent pregnancy after a man's sperm has fertilized a woman's egg. Reverend Dr. Matthew C. Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church, says we object to the use of drugs and procedures used to take the lives of unborn children.
They are not unborn children.
Sometimes when a fetus begins to develop and show the characteristics of what will eventually
be a human being.
Be a human being and not an unborn child. It's a fetus. That's why they have different names to describe different things.
That's true. It's a different category.
Yeah. They're talking about something almost microscopic, and they're calling it an unborn child. And if they want to do that, that's absolutely their right, you know.
Yeah.
And if they want to call it that, they can call it whatever they want. But back out of our lives. And, you know, you're always, you know, women have the greatest vested interest in this question, of course.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing more annoying. There's nothing more annoying than hearing these old men tell me what to do with my body.
And they're wrong, too. Several scientists and doctors said in interviews that this view did not reflect the way birth control methods actually work. There's so much evidence for these things that work prior to fertilization. And there's no evidence that they work beyond fertilization. So, you know, she and other experts, this was Diana L. Blythe, director of the Contraceptive Development for the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. Oh, child health. Well, who cares about that, right? Not these guys.
Yeah, they're too busy worrying about what women are doing. And they're not worrying about, say, the story that we both read this week about the amount of kids who are dying of malnutrition around the world.
I want to get to that. Yeah. Hey, by the way, and so these folks that don't want contraception, well, this article in the New York Times says it used to be called illegitimacy. Now it's the new normal. After steadily rising for five decades, the share of women born to unmarried women has crossed a threshold. More than half of births to American women under 30 occur outside of marriage.
This was amazing to me.
So who's doing it? It must be, you know, them.
Who?
You know, those other people. Well, it turns out you're wrong. Once largely limited to poor women and minorities, motherhood without marriage has settled deeply into middle America. The fastest growth in the last two decades has occurred among white women in their 20s who have some college education. So
I know a lot of single moms. all colors.
Yeah, not that I don't, you know, on the face of it, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing immoral or unethical.
No, and some, hey, listen, some people, it just doesn't, the relationship doesn't work out. Sometimes it's an abusive relationship, and they're better off not being with that person. There are so many reasons that they are going through this alone, you know.
Among mothers of all ages, a majority, 59% in 2009, are married when they have children, which means 41% don't. But the surge of births outside of marriage among younger women, nearly two-thirds of children in the United States are born to mothers under 30, is both a symbol of the transforming family and a hint of coming generational change.
Amazing. And I thought this was the sociologist from the University of Pennsylvania said, marriage has become a luxury good. I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
I didn't consider it a luxury at all.
Also, in the in the New York Times, they had this profile of this Catholic priest, Reverend Roger J. Landry. How do they describe him? Where is the guy here? Can't find that particular thing. But anyway, he believes the official Catholic teaching about contraception. He's not afraid to say so. He preaches about it all the time. Oh, here he is. Father Landry, 41, is balding, ruddy, and blue-eyed. And he speaks quickly and confidently.
What a description.
He gives his parishioners the stiff 80-proof doctrine. The church hierarchy bans all artificial contraception and the withdrawal method.
What?
I mean, they are really... Talk about being in your bedroom.
I mean, my God, they're describing it.
Yeah. Well, you know, we about Iraq, they used to say about George Bush. Remember, they said you should pull out of...
out of
Iraq the way your daddy should have.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah.
We enjoyed that one.
Now get this. The only permissible forms of birth control are abstinence. Oh, thank you.
Yeah, gee.
Yeah. We'll be, well, I don't know.
That's real normal.
Yeah.
That's real healthy.
And natural family planning, using knowledge of a woman's cycle to restrict intercourse to times when she is unlikely to conceive. Now that's called either papal roulette. Right?
Right.
And, you know, there's a way, what is it, taking a temperature and everything like that.
Yeah, the basal thermometer.
Oh, yeah, so you, like, if you want to have a baby, you know, you can say, yeah, I'm ovulating, come on, let's do it, so we can have a baby if you're having trouble doing it. So that obviously is done to avoid pregnancy. So why is that okay in their little twisted view of things? Father Landry also gives sermons on contraception. Here's what he says, that God made us fundamentally for love. I like that. So good.
But love doesn't include intimacy, according to him, because just because he can't have sex doesn't mean the rest of us can't.
And that marriage is supposed to help us to love for real. Okay. That's all right. I think you can love outside of marriage pretty easily. But I think you can.
I think you can love more than one person at one time. But call me a hippie.
Yeah. You're a hippie.
Okay.
In order for that to happen, says Father Landry, we need to totally give ourselves over to someone else in love and receive the other's total self in love. I like the guy's...
Oh, he's on a really good roll.
Yeah,
here.
He's on a roll. What happens in the use of contraception? Rather than embracing us totally as God made the other with the masculine capacity to become a dad or the feminine capacity to become a mom, we reject that paternal and maternal leaning. You see where this guy is going?
All about procreation.
Every time we do it,
you're supposed to have a baby. Right. Some big Catholic families out there.
Yeah, I'd be having a big family.
Yeah.
don't mean to brag.
You could have fill up.
Hold on. Where are we going here?
A few radio stations full of kids. Little Werbies.
Yeah. Father Landry argues that conception can be the gateway to exploitation.
Whoa.
What's he talking about here?
Maybe sometimes people want to be exploited.
But he says when that petition is made for contraception, in other words, when you want to use it, it's going to make pleasure the point of the act, and any time pleasure becomes the point rather than the fruit of the act, the other person becomes the means to that end, and we're actually going to hurt the people we love.
That's ridiculous.
What the hell does that mean?
That is the stupidest thing I've heard all day.
What do you think about that, folks?
Sex for enjoyment or sex for what? What's it for then?
Non-Catholics and many Catholics, because the vast majority of Catholics use contraception. See, the church's teaching on contraception is cruel towards women. Do you think?
Amen.
Previously, before contraception, this is one of the big changes, the technological changes of the human history, along with Adam
Bomb. As far as health goes.
Yeah, well, certainly the big one. And in human relations, because it really freed women from procreation unless they agreed to do it.
Thank you, Jesus.
The men determined everything. Right?
And in some areas of the world, men still do determine everything.
Right. Father Landry says it's the women who intuitively get how divorcing sex from procreation allows men to use them. Jeez. See, this is the whole...
Call me used, Father.
Organized religion, the tenets of organized religion see sex as something base and vile and only to be used. I mean, say...
No wonder there's so many repressed people, and no wonder there's so many sexual crimes. I mean, this is how young men are raised.
Sexual repression is directly linked to authoritarian personalities, for one thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. In his...
Sexual fascists.
Yeah, exactly. And fascists.
Yeah.
So... I don't know. Any thoughts on that? 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. And I don't know.
Well, I think it was just a very disturbing week as far as women go.
Let me say this. All societies have rules.
Sure.
About sexuality and life bonding, childbearing, child raising, and all
more
of that.
Norms.
Yeah, norms. Things would be kind of chaotic. One of the things people think in history, we have prehistory, really, is that women been creating some idea of family so that the fathers did not have sex with the daughters.
Ew.
But if there weren't those social rules, it would just be another female. And the male drive... Is to procreate. I mean, it's part of our genetic patterning. Patterning.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, pattering. What is pattering? You pitter pat down the hall.
Right. Yes, well, you're right about that.
And again, I'm not trying to make any excuses for sometimes bad behavior on the part of men. But the idea, for instance, that men, and this is more of a stereotype than actual, reality, is that men will get rid of a wife they've had for years and years and marry a much younger woman.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just saying, what a cad, what a jerk, what
lack of commitment. It happens all the time.
It does. But a lot of it is, I think, genetic drive towards procreation. Again, I'm not trying to excuse any type of behavior.
Yeah, right. You're not saying that the upgrade is acceptable.
Right, socially. And when you've got guys in hospices grabbing a nurse's ass, they're going to die in 3 weeks, and yet there's still a little, little signal still from.
I used to work at a nursing home
when
I was in high school and a little bit in college, and I remember old Walter. he had a grabby hands, and I finally had to go to the nurse's desk and say, listen, I'm not dealing with Walter anymore. And he could have six beers a night. He had his little cooler in his room, so the more beers that he had in his little room, the more grabby he got. So, yeah, Walter had the little
Yeah, or, you know, maybe I'm putting too much. He could have just been an a-hole.
No, I don't know. Right. Maybe it was the Budweiser.
What a jerk. I mean, get it together.
It was pretty creepy.
One of the things is that overwhelming support, both among Catholics and non-Catholics, for birth control coverage is everywhere. Yeah, yeah, majority of Catholic voters in the poll were at odds with the church's official stance. Jennifer Davison, a Catholic from Lomita, California, agrees with the federal requirement that says that secular employees of Catholic institutions have to be offered birth control. And it's not even these church hospitals or whatever that are going to offer it.
Like St. Mary's or St. John's or whatever.
Yeah. The insurance companies are going to pick up the cost. And Jennifer Davison said, my opinion is that it is a personal issue rather than a religious issue. Well, that's the way most people feel. But once you've got on board with that train, it's a religious issue, because what is being proscribed here is personal choice.
Yeah, on everyone who comes to that institution.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't really care, as long as you're not hurting anyone else, what your choices are. Sometimes I would kind of raise my eyebrows, but I'm not going to say anything to you. But why are these guys trying to enforce this kind of behavior on either their employees or all of us? And why are they so nuts? But, I mean, get this. I mean, what did Rick Santorum say about birth control? That it was harmful? Something I can't remember. But in any event, essentially, guys and gals, he wants, every time you have sex, he wants you to have the possibility of becoming pregnant. This is the compulsory pregnancy movement. It's not just abortion, but then you see it really begins with contraception. And they will give nothing to intimacy, pleasure, and I know they would hate this word, to lust.
Oh, no.
And lust.
The dreaded lust.
Yeah, isn't that one of the seven deadly sins or something?
I don't know. Lust is fun.
Well,
and it doesn't last very long.
And as long as, as long as it's mutual lust, as long as it's not about...
creepy one-sided lust.
creepy one-sided lust. What the hell's wrong with lust?
Yeah, please, someone. If anyone can answer that question, 313-298-9743.
I had one more thing here, too. And I think
our audience is too cool to argue with that one.
I think so, too. Oh, by the way, you know, remember I was talking about Mitt and Rick and Newton Ron?
Yeah.
That they all had these nicknames, which I just don't get. You know, Barack Obama has they call him Barry.
Do they really?
Yeah, I think Michelle calls him Barry. Am I right, folks?
I never knew that.
Yeah, I think so. So anyway. I had, let me, one other thought about sex.
You know, too. If he had just gotten
with... I
had
lots of thoughts about sex.
Well, these Catholics have been putting it in our heads all week, you know?
Did you see here, this is just totally sex. Did you see the cover of the Sports Illustrated?
I did. The swimsuit model? I saw it at the 7-Eleven the other day.
You know, she's related to this Republican, either former or current Congressman Upton. What's her
name?
Is
she really?
Yeah, her last name. Her last name is up there.
I don't know her name. I just saw the picture.
Did you see the bottom of it? It is the smallest bottom.
Oh, you mean, look at me. The bottom's to her bikini?
Yeah.
No, what did she, was she wearing bottoms?
It's, I mean, talk about teeny weeny, what was that song in the 50s? Teeny weeny polka dot bikini?
Itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini.
Wow, yeah. I mean,
yeah, well, she's a pretty lady.
So you're sure this
you
is not a...
You gotta flaunt it.
You're sure about this in that song that he knows when you are sleeping, he knows that when you're awake...
That's Santa Claus!
That he is not God, that he is Santa Claus.
Yes, that's what I was told.
Can anybody affirm this?
Peter, that's how unholiday-like you've been all these years.
Yeah, I don't think you're right. I mean, they always do the big capital.
So you think that this is a ruse?
What?
You think it's undercover God operation, Santa Claus?
No, I don't know. I'm just kind of shocked here. Let me, By the way, let me see. There was something. Oh, you were mentioning about the children.
Oh,
this
yeah.
This is absolutely. Oh, yeah. The hunger epidemic. 300 children die every hour from malnutrition as the world's poor cut back on food.
I mean, 300 children die every
hour.
Hour. When I first read it, I thought, oh, it's, you know, a year or a month. But an hour? And they're so worried about our unborn children or little, what did you call them?
Microscopic
things.
Yeah,
right.
Those are unborn children.
These sickos are so worried about little microscopic things while 300 children are dying every single hour in this world.
And which, because of the maldistribution of income, is, there's no need for it. By the way, I didn't get this up on my website, but there's a new little chart about where you can put in your income and see what percentage of the world.
Yeah, like, because we're like the we're talking always about the 99% and the 1%.
I would suspect, no matter what your income listening is, and I'm talking about you may have a real low income.
You're in the 99%.
You're in the, like, the upper 5%, and good numbers of us are in the 1%. I'm in the 0.09%. I don't make a hell of a lot of money. I mean, I forgot how many hundreds and hundreds of millions of people live on less than $2, less than $1 a day.
Yeah.
So when you start, when you're talking about people that are making $400 and $500 a year, if you're making $12,000 a year, you're probably in the 96th percentile of world, of world stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, I had this, I got too many pieces of paper. But if you look up, richest, the percentage of wealth in the world, I mean, it's staggering how few number of men, the three richest men in the world have more wealth than 42 countries.
My gosh.
I mean, and in those countries, you think there's at least part of that 300 an hour starving? And again, there's nothing in the world that these people can personally consume. They have wealth hoarded. They're Scrooge McDucks, except it's not a joke, because the hoarding of wealth, the concentration of wealth, winds up in the immiseration of hundreds of millions, probably a couple billion people,
mm-hmm.
And hundreds of millions of people, their lives are just, horrible.
Yeah, miserable. I thought this was interesting in the article about malnutrition, is that it's a condition that occurs not because of inadequate supply of food all the time, lack of dietary protein in vegetables, milk, or meat. They don't have food sources.
Yeah.
And then what about water? You know, that's the next oil.
Sure. Indeed. By the way, I cannot see who's on line number one, so if you could rewrite the name. Athena, and wait a minute. Here, Amanda is going to be our first caller, because she wants to talk about... So you think it's the Santa song. It's not a religious song.
No, it's you better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming.
Oh, that's right. So it's got Santa...
He's making a list.
Told you, Peter.
Find out who's naughty or nice. Santa Claus is coming. Anyway, and I actually had a second comment. About the sex thing earlier. I believe my biology class, when I was listening to you guys talk, we are the only animal, I believe, or one of the only animals that does sex for pleasure. So that could be another factor, at least maybe for males.
What do you mean for males?
For the men who are trying to control our...
Oh, yeah. Well, that's interesting. I mean...
Because there's studies show that as a woman gets ages, sometimes she has a less sexual appetite.
Yeah.
And I don't think it changes for a man. So, I mean, that could be the other issue why men have been looking for younger women, because they usually have a higher sex drive to match themselves.
Well, plus they can just go down to the 7-Eleven and get some Extends or whatever.
Or
the guy who owns the party store by my house says that he has one. I can't remember what it's called.
What is it?
I don't know what it is.
I mean, it's you eat it, drink it?
It's a pill.
Snort it?
And he said that he's got a guy who comes in there, and he's like 80, and he comes in and gets his little pills, and it works. He said it's like for 3 days that whenever you want to do it, you can do it.
Well, I don't know if we have some women that are in middle age or older, but the
we didn't need these drugs to come along, man.
Yeah, the bane of middle-aged women is their husband who's just retired and starting to take enjoys home all the time, and he's taking Viagra.
No doubt about it.
All right,
I've
Amanda.
Had enough of you.
Thank you very much. I was just someone who she's, you know, I can't bend over to pick up a, you know, never mind. Yeah. Here is, Stan is in Farmington, wants to talk about lust. I was saying nothing wrong with
are
lust.
Are you going to answer my question, Stan?
I'm going to try.
Okay.
I think there's a couple problems with it. First of all, you can act, you know, without thinking about it. You know, lack of protection leads to unwanted pregnancies. The second problem I see with it is sometimes lust between two people can become one-sided love, and then someone ends up getting hurt.
No, it's all possible. But one of the things,
that's small percentage, though.
I know that it happens. That sometimes, I mean, I've talked to the guys and the women. I said, "When they, I mean, how did you get pregnant?" He said, "I don't know, just." Isn't there a song? A David Bowie tune, we play it on the air, he never lost his head while giving head, right?
I mean,
is that okay to say? I mean, it's in the song. I forgot what song? You know, Walk on the Wild Side.
Oh.
It's right in there. We play it. Come on.
That's not David Bowie.
Who is it?
Isn't it?
No,
Lou Reed?
Is it Lou Reed?
Walk on the Wild Side?
Yeah, it's Lou Reed. You're right. Sorry. I get those two confused.
Well, I'm a classic rock DJ. If I didn't get that right.
Yeah, you know, you're right. You're right. Yeah, and that's on the same album with You're So Vicious.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Anyway, it's okay. Any event.
He had a theme going
on
there.
But, Stan, so what are you saying? We should never surrender to lust?
No, I think it's just human nature to lust after people. Just, you know, it's one of those unfortunate side effects, something that's enjoyable.
Have you been hurt by lust, Stan?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, well, then what do they say? Twice burned, once shy. Or is it once burned, twice shy? I'm like George Bush.
Don't ever say that again either.
Wait a minute.
You are not like George Bush.
Remember he said something about...
Oh, yeah.
Fool me once, fool me again.
And then he just stopped.
Yeah, he stopped. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I think you should do.
That's a Mott the Hoople tune, okay?
Mott the Hoople, okay.
All right, I got it.
All right,
Stan,
young girls.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a downside to everything. And lust is a big high, which means it has the capacity for a big low as well. All right, we'll be right back. More with lust and sex and Santa Claus. Ooh. And did Mitt Romney really take his dog to Canada on the roof of his car? We all know that's the case.
He did.
But did he come back?
He's a son of a...
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Yeah, I just found out why Jay always volunteers to make the office beverage run to McDonald's every day.
Why?
Seems if you buy 5 hot McCafe beverages or premium roast coffee, the 6th one's free.
So we've been paying for ours and he's been getting his free?
Yeah.
I cannot believe Jay would do such a thing.
Think of something so genius.
Yeah.
Wish I would have thought of that.
Totally.
It's McCafe Rewards. Collect 5 stickers from any hot, medium, or large McCafe beverages or fresh brewed premium roast coffee and your 6th one is free. Limited time offer at participating McDonald's.
If you're overwhelmed by debt and thinking about going to a credit counseling company for help, think again. Because the majority of those companies actually work for the credit card companies. And they make the credit card companies a lot of money. From people just like you. But there's another way out of debt, and it's not bankruptcy. A way to reduce your debts and save you thousands of dollars. Even better, you can find out how for free by calling 1-800-941-9246. At Freedom Debt Relief, we're not a credit counseling organization. We're not a debt consolidation company. We offer a unique alternative to save you the most money possible to resolve your debt in the shortest amount of time. If you're thinking about a credit counselor, ask yourself this. Are they working for you or the credit card companies? Reduce your debts and save thousands of dollars by learning the secrets to settling your debt. For free information, call 1-800-941-9246. That's 1-800-941-9246. 1-800-941-9246.
This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
we're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much and welcome back. We're taking your calls on lots of subjects, and if we kind of stray into others, you can still comment on what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
We began essentially saying, we didn't say this outright, but maybe we did. I think we did. That religion should have no part in politics. It has an ugly, ugly history, and that's why the founding fathers made the Constitution a secular document that begins with the no establishment of religion, says there never should be a religious test, and the fact that this small percentage of the population, almost exclusively right-wing, is always whipsawing us around with all this stuff and coming out with the nuttiest ideas, including Rick Santorum, who supports the idea of no contraception, which talk about compulsory pregnancy. And to him, there's no room in the world for, what, lust.
Yeah.
We were talking about lust, but lots of other things as well. You, you had a little item?
Oh, yeah.
We have some
emails. We were talking
about
Mitt Romney a little bit. We teased that we were going to talk about his animal abuse.
Crate gate,
yeah, because if you haven't heard this, years back, he actually put his dog in a crate on top of the car and drove from Massachusetts to
Canada
with that dog in the crate. And he said, "See, must like to ride up there." Well, now there is Dogs Against Romney. I'm a member. And they just protested outside the big dog show in New York City, which I love. Anyway, just got an email an email from Alex who said, "Hey, a couple days ago I heard someone refer to Romney supporters as Romulans."
Romulans.
He said thought we would appreciate the humor since we're always looking for names. But Romulans, doesn't it seem just as the name of ancient, archaic ideas?
Yeah.
Like it.
Here Sue is in Harrison Township. She has a question about Romney. Go ahead, Sue. You're on the air.
I was just going to say, first of all, my dog hates Romney, too.
Good. What's your dog's name?
Chloe.
Hi. Who's a good girl, Chloe?
Oh, she's wonderful.
That's when Jalene comes over our house and dog talks to our little girl.
I'm crazy like that, too. I don't have a working computer right now.
Uh-huh.
And somebody told me that Romney, we call him Biff at my house.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good enough name.
Yes. That he believes in magic underwear.
Oh, yeah. That's
what
part of
our magic underwear.
Yeah, I don't know this
That's
either.
Part of the Mormon religion.
What? Oh. What does it mean? So they don't
wear undergarments. So they wear.
Oh, it's an undergarment thing. I do know about that.
Yeah. Now, I mean, look, it's.
And they're magical?
Well, I don't know. You can't, you can't turn lead into gold. I'm not even sure.
I'm confused too.
I don't know what function, they have. I mean, one of the things that the Mormons do also is they do, what's the word for it? They baptize people after they're dead. Like they were baptizing, and I mean, they obviously couldn't do it with the actual body, but they were baptizing Holocaust victims recently. And they'll baptize like John Kennedy or, I mean, and people want to say, wow, that religion's so weird and spooky. I guess I don't think it's much, Hey, listen.
A lot of it's pretty spooky.
Yeah, yeah. I have
They're all mental illness, I think.
Well,
yeah.
Hey, you know what's
you
happening?
<said it. laughs>
You know what is happening, Sue? There's going to be this huge rally in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, March 24th. It's called the Reason Rally, and it's going to be the largest secular gathering in world history, and it's bringing together atheists, agnostics, and just people that want to hang out. With featured speaker is Richard Dawkins, the evolutionary biologist who's quite prominent.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So,
good.
Yeah. And they say there's probably 40 to 50 million atheists in the United States. And even though we say we're this heavily religious country, when they really start digging deeply into people's beliefs, it's the old thing. It's a mile wide and an inch deep. I mean, the really strongly religious people in this country are probably equal to the number of atheists.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
And atheists are good people.
They are.
Well, we are.
You have to hide behind God.
Well, and that is a popular train of thought. So sometimes I feel that's true, too.
Thank you, Sue.
Okay. Good night.
Thanks,
appreciate
Sue.
It. You have a good night.
See you, Chloe. Who's your good girl? Who's your good Chloe?
We always say it's Auntie Jolene and our little doggy.
It's a whole thing.
Yeah. All right. Mitt Romney, this is according to, it's on my website at Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, according to Politicker.com. Mitt Romney may not have told the whole truth about the scandalous tale of his Irish setter, Seamus, being strapped to the roof of his car during a 12-hour family road trip to Canada.
12 hours!
For most people, that's enough. He says, oh, he loved it. He just jumps up there. Now, how can an Irish setter jump to the top of a car? I mean, come on. Two of Mr. Romney's son had an off-record conversation with reporters where they revealed the dog ran away when they reached their destination on that infamous journey in 1983.
Did they ever get it back?
I don't think so.
See, this... Oh.
Romney's wife, Ann, has previously said Seamus survived the trip and went on to live to a ripe old age. As of this writing...
Survived the trip! Well, isn't that lovely?
Mr. Romney's campaign did not responded to multiple requests for comment on the story.
This is a bad one. People don't like when people abuse animals.
It gets worse. It came to light in 2007, and he told that Romney himself told the story of the voyage to his father's cottage on the gated Beech O' Pines community on Ontario's Lake Huron. He says the white Chevy station wagon with the wood paneling was overstuffed with suitcases, supplies, and sons when Mitt Romney climbed behind the wheel to begin the annual 12-hour family trek from Boston to Ontario. Before beginning the drive, Mitt Romney put Seamus, the family's hulking Irish setter, in a dog carrier and attached it to the station wagon's roof rack. He had built a windshield for the carrier to make the ride more comfortable for the dog. Okay, so...
Oh, he did
yeah,
he?
Yeah.
Well,
according to the Globe, Romney told his family he would, quote, be making predetermined stops for gas, and that was it. But one of his sons, Tag... That's his son.
That sounds like a Palin name.
I was going to say, one of his sons, Tag, eventually noticed something. You ready for this?
What?
Something was amiss.
What? What?
This might be one of these things we're not going to be able to continue.
we still have 10 minutes left in this segment, Peter.
I don't know if I can read it.
What is it?
All right, come on. I'm a pro.
Yeah. You can do this.
As the oldest son, Tag Romney.
I don't even know what it is, and it's funny.
God, dude. We gotta go back to it later.
Why don't you let me read it?
All right. Well, how can you? Wait a minute. I don't. It's just up on the screen. Okay.
Hold on. I'm coming over there.
Okay. You're listening to Night
Call. This is the first.
All right. Here. As the oldest son,
Tag Romney commandeered the way back of the wagon, keeping his eyes fixed out the rear window, where he glimpsed the first sign of trouble. Dad! He yelled. Gross! A brown liquid was dripping down the back window. Payback from an Irish setter who'd been riding on the roof in the wind for hours.
There you go.
I'll poop on your car, Mitt.
Okay, but get this. Romney responded to the dog's defecation by coolly stopping at a gas station where he borrowed a hose, washed down Seamus in the car, then hopped back into the highway with Seamus strapped back on the roof.
Don't come. Come here, buddy. Come inside. Oh, poor baby.
Yeah.
I mean, the dog, Peter, the dog could have been on someone's lap for crying out loud.
Well, he said this was an example of Mr. Romney's, quote, emotion-free crisis management.
So that means he's going to be a good president?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
when he's pressing the big button? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Seamus inspired an attack ad from Mr. Romney's Republican rival, Newt Gingrich, a Google bomb coining Romney as a verb meaning to defecate in terror. I can't stand it. When's the bus leaving for the next planet? Get these guys out of our lives, please.
Oh, it hurts.
Oh, man.
Oh, Peter. I mean, you can't write this stuff.
No. All right, let's get some more people on the air. Here's Eric in Southgate. Eric, hi. You're on the air with Peter and Jolene. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Talk about attention deficit disorder. Hello, Jolene. I'm Mr. Peter.
Yes.
Hello. You mean Peter and I?
No, I mean Jolene. I'm Mr. Peter. And Mr. Peter, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Who has ADD? You mean Peter and I have ADD?
I'm saying that MC5 kick out the jams, forefathers. Yeah. Now, I want to talk about the Hash Bash, what happened to me last year. And it's, are you guys still there?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Hash Bash coming up first Saturday in April. Yeah.
You know, if you can't make the high noon at that Diag, there's Dominic's, two blocks south. But last year I took my 17-year-old girlfriend, and they treated her like Elizabeth Smart, and like I was some kind of Muslim.
If I could ask.
Okay, first of all.
How old are you, Eric?
I'm, well, baby.
What? Oh, my God.
You're 50 what?
I'm 40 years old.
Oh, 40. And you have a 17-year-old girlfriend?
Well, she's probably almost 18
now. No, she's 18. And
oh, that's good.
She's 18. You want to hear about my 21-year-old girlfriend?
No.
Just, we had to take her back to third rehab, but her grandma took her back.
Well, you're... this is a bad argument
talking
for lust.
Talking about ADD.
Yeah.
No. I had a friend that died from heroin.
Yeah. Talk about ADD, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. In 2005, he told me all about heaven. Dimebag Darrell.
Wait, he died and came back?
No, Dimebag Darrell, that's, yes.
Yes, what? And the best Iron Maiden.
Musician.
I mean, oh, yeah, yeah.
Iron
yeah.
Butterfly album. In Search of the Lost Chord.
In Agata David.
A lot of the listeners of this radio station love themselves some Dimebag Darrell.
We'll see you down the road, maybe at the Hash Bash.
or another planet somewhere.
Another planet, because we're waiting for the bus. Right.
Yes.
Here is Maurice in Detroit. Huh? Maurice, what's up, man?
Hey, hello, Peter. Hello, Julie.
Hello.
Hi. I got a little problem. I hope somebody out there can help me with.
Okay.
Oh, no.
Do you have love-itis?
No.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
That's what we're talking about,
Peter,
but go ahead.
Hey, Peter, let me finish, okay? Back in December 2007, when I was in Hamtramck, I had four guns stolen from me.
He was in Hamtramck.
Oh, yeah, okay. And you had four what?
Guns. Well, one of the guns was a Model 39 Smith & Wesson semi-automatic 9mm.
Okay.
Damn.
Okay. Now, 2 months ago, I get a call from the Hamtramck police, a detective, Crackiola, called me up and tell me to recover one of my guns that was used in a murder in Highland Park.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
That's not so good,
but
Maurice.
This is the catch. It wasn't the gun I reported stolen. The gun that they retrieved was my Model 59. At the time, the Model 59 was in the shop being worked on, which is already, the guy I talked to, he got it when he logged it in and logged it back. Okay, I went and got that gun from him in February.
What phase is the moon
on a Tuesday? My thing is this.
It just got done being fall.
I tried to explain this to the detective sergeant, the raid investigation, detective sergeant, the Juan Powell, the Michigan State Police, no call. I called a supervisor, first sergeant Vicki Johnson, no call. See,
Maurice, let's deal with the headlines here. What's the long and the short of it?
You're not in trouble though.
The problem is, I got a gun out there that I can't report stolen. My Model 39 that I initially reported stolen in December 2007.
Well, I don't have any real advice on that, but gee, when a man gets four of his guns stolen, what's he to do?
What I say, I know who sold the gun that gave it to somebody to kill this guy in Highland Park, and nobody calling me back.
Well, I see.
Well, I hope they call you back.
Yeah.
Did you get another gun, Maurice? Did you load back up?
Oh yeah, I got a Sig, a Glock, and a Colt 45.
Hey, you are ready.
Hey, Peter, when.
What?
S hits the fan. We're going to Maurice's.
We're in.
Yeah.
All right, Maurice. Good luck on it. Keep trying, man. We got to get bad boys off of the streets. Thank you. Here is Jimmy in Manchester. Jimmy, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for calling us on WRIF.
Hey, how you doing? You know, your show just kills me.
It kills me, man.
I love your show. You crack me up.
Oh, man.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know who? I haven't called in a long time, but. I'm back.
You're back.
Well, welcome back.
This is like poltergeist.
Yeah, I got a proposition for you. Let's, you and I, start a constitutional initiative in the state of Michigan to ban contraception.
Okay.
It'll be hilarious because we can point out how absurd this argument is.
Yeah.
Because no one's going to vote for it. No.
Right.
Even people that don't, I don't use contraception with my wife, and I'll vote against it.
We're getting into the TMI zone, Jimmy.
they don't even want you to use the pull-out method, though.
Yeah.
Well, no, I'm not going to talk about what I use, but that's none of your business.
Well, I know.
The fact that we don't use contraception, that's a big deal. So what? You know that. Wow. So what? Leave it up to your own lustful imagination.
Oh, God! We're not going to lust.
I'll just be fantasizing about you, Jimmy, for the next, I don't know what.
Till next Sunday.
You know what I look like.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
Let me describe myself. No.
What's your sign, Jimmy?
Let's try to ban contraception, use the 10th Amendment, and point out how absurd this whole thing is so that we can send a message to all of these other idiots that are trying to run for whatever it is they're running for and say, look, you know, we don't believe your BS anymore.
Well, that's probably an excellent idea.
Yes.
I don't know. An amendment is pretty stuffy.
I like when our listeners think outside of the box.
It's time for business, Jimmy, so welcome back. We got to take a break, and then we'll be back to get more of your calls. And let's just keep going with this. Got a lot of other things to talk about. Most of them too serious.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Hey, moms, if your child's birthday is right around the corner, then listen up, because the next 60 seconds will save you time, hassle, and money. Don't waste your valuable time wandering around the party supply store. BirthdayExpress.com has you covered with everything you need to make your child's next birthday the best one ever. From favors and treats to balloons, games, and decorations, BirthdayExpress.com has it all in stock, ready to be shipped directly to you. Fast and easy. Even better, go to BirthdayExpress.com today, use promo code PARTY, and get 15% off everything. Doing a theme? Birthday Express has an enormous selection, including brands you can't find anywhere else, like WWE, Mario Kart, and Yo Gabba Gabba. If your kids are talking about it, we have it. Birthday Express makes it fast and easy for you to be the super mom you are. You can even personalize your party supplies with a child's name or picture. How cool is that? Just go to BirthdayExpress.com today and use code PARTY for 15% off. That's BirthdayExpress.com. Promo code PARTY. BirthdayExpress.com. Code PARTY.
This is an urgent message for all individuals with extremely large credit card debt. No matter how much you owe, the company that has settled more credit card debt than anyone in the U.S. can settle your debt too, while you make one low monthly program payment. You now have the opportunity to hear how low your monthly program payment could be for free. To find out how much you could save, call Freedom Debt Relief 1-800-928-1065, 1-800-928-1065, 1-800-928-1065.
Thanks for rocking with the riff online. This is WRIF.com.
In the name.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Ritz award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
313-298-WRIF. That was taken from that kind of reverend kind of rap there at the beginning.
Yeah.
With Reverend Jesse Crawford, self-anointed reverend, who was the stage announcer for Detroit's famous MC5. Michael Davis, the bass player, passed away at age 68 just Friday, I guess.
So
we salute him and the remaining members.
Of the MC5.
Of the MC5, yeah. So open lines for you, 313-298-WRIF. Ron Paul Richard, I'll call him, sent us an email, a little video of Ron Paul saying, we're slipping into a fascist system. So the guy's half good on
half,
some of this.
Half.
But all of his other stuff about women's rights and minimum wage and all of that, terrible. Horrible.
Yep.
But I just looked him up, and his name is Ronald.
Okay. So because the reason we're saying that is we're talking about how Mitt is Mitt instead of
Willard.
Willard. Yeah. Which is, did they just turn the W upside down?
Maybe it was a nickname. I thought it was because Mitt is this, if you hold your hand up, it's, he's from Michigan.
A mitten,
yeah. So like a mitten.
The mitten state.
So it's
Newt.
Newton Gingrich.
Yeah. And Rick.
Richard Santorum.
Yeah.
And Ronald Paul.
And Ronald Paul.
Yeah. Richard Santorum.
Like, make them a little more casual, like the everyday commoner.
Yeah, right? I guess so. But what do we say in fairness? There was Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
And
pretty soon they'll have their plaid shirts on, and they're...
Well, already. Have you noticed how many suits that Romney wears? He wears Levi's all the time now.
Okay.
Because he's just one of the folks.
No, just one of the guys.
They're pressed.
Oh, with the line,
Levi's, yeah,
the crease in front.
Yeah, I know some people. They must, guys, single guys. They must send everything to the laundry, and they got creases in their Levi's.
You have no creases in your Levi's.
I have no creases in my Levi's.
And nor do I.
Santorum, by the way, if you Google it, Santorum, you get a pretty weird first hit. Adults only, please. But besides calling President Obama's agenda, which I don't even know what his agenda is, I wish he had a more overt, what they call social democratic agenda.
I wish he was the total socialist that they are claiming.
He's not.
All of those things that they claim that Barack Obama is, it would be great.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, not a Muslim terrorist.
Right. Well, I mean, that is just so far from reality. These people are whacked.
Yeah. So Santorum, though, as we were saying at the beginning of the show, was saying, the other thing is that he is criticizing the fact that the Obama health plan, and if they want to call it Obamacare, I think it's just a testimony to the man. The fact, the problem is, not that it's there, that it's too weak, that it ought to be a national health program, socialized medicine, that we wouldn't be facing so many of the things that people, that we do as a society and certainly as individuals.
And people dying because of the lack of health care, the biggest. Right,
what do they say? 44,000 people a year in the United States. But he, Santorum, is also upset because the health plan requires insurers to pay for prenatal tests.
I mean, isn't that a good thing?
No.
The health of the baby, the health of the woman?
He's against amniocentesis.
Really? So in case
because then he says it encourages abortions.
Oh, man.
This is one sick piece of work.
Well, and he's the sickest one in the pack, really, I think.
Yeah, he's past Newt.
Yeah.
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 You got to remember, too, is that Rick Santorum, in 2008, lost his re-election bid as senator in Pennsylvania by, I think, 17%.
Wow.
I mean, he was so overwhelmingly rejected by the voters of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so take a clue from that, people who like Santorum. Oh, you know what, Peter? I think we should take this phone call because we promised we'd get back to him.
Okay, 313-298-WRIF, and here's Lucado in Detroit. Lucado, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. And next week, please close up the liquor cabinet. You well, have to call my
Wait. Let's go over that one more time.
What?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Close up the liquor cabinet.
Close the liquor cabinet. Okay. Who,
yeah.
Us or the callers or all of us?
The callers.
Okay.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're high on life.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely. It's the best way. And my comment is, speaking about the Jackson 4, without Michael, my comment is they want to make pro-choice a thing of the past. They should change it from pro-choice to, I'm sorry, pro-life to pro-birth, because they want the child to be born. They let the child be born. That's it. They have nothing else to do for the child, want to do nothing else for the child, want the child have to live. And so why choose pro-life once the child is born, then they don't want to have no programs out there for the mother or the child to health care is gone. Anything else for the child is non-existent. They had their way.
Right.
Well, no, you're right, Lucado. I mean, it is just more about sexual repression because they couldn't care less about the children, because if they did, they would do things like they do in Canada where mothers would get a monthly stipend to make sure that the child always has available funds. I mean, what's the figure, Jalene? Isn't it like 30 million kids in the United States go to bed at night at risk of hunger?
It was, what, 1 in 5?
Yeah. And they want to go back. There's too many things to save. But there's this whole desire to unfold all of these social programs of a country that has such a disproportionately high number of poor people in it. And, now about half of us are getting some sort of government aid. And without it, I don't know what the hell they expect. It would be back like, 1840s in England. It would be, like a Charles Dickens novel. Lucado, thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. So Santorum getting weirder and weirder. And and he's also questioning the whole idea of schools run by state governments.
And so he wants everything
state board.
For everything to be privatized.
Yeah, he homeschools his kids. And there's a couple of things going. I mean, being a right-wing whack job, a white-wing rack job, he doesn't want his children infected with liberal ideologies that dominate public schools.
Those poor kids are screwed.
So, I mean, this kind of insane political ideology has to be staffed with people that believe it. Because, I almost hesitate to say this. I think I said this last week. I mean, calling, if you're on the left, you call your right-wing enemies fascists, and then, people of the right-wing call all of us communists.
Yeah.
You say it doesn't get anywhere. But this really is proto-fascist. I mean, pre-fascist mentality. Everything about them, the violence, the militarism, the guns that they're so nuts about, the sexual repression, the idea, the domination of women, the patriarch, all of this stuff, heavy nationalism, religion, all of it. I mean, it's you go back and see the history, particularly of religious countries like Spain and Italy, and you just see where all of this comes from.
And even scarier is that he even has as many people who want to vote for him as he has now, and then it's increased.
Well, one thing we should do, because the headlines will say that, Santorum and Romney pitch their ideas to Michigan voters. They're not pitching them to a Michigan voters. I mean, you want to have some precision there. I mean, I write headlines for newspapers and magazines sometimes, and you want to say that they pitch it to Republican voters.
Yeah, for sure.
And when the votes come in next Tuesday, we have a state of 7.5 million people. I don't know how many adults that amounts to, but check out how many people voted for each of these guys. It's not going to wind up to be a very big percentage. Certainly each of them individually, it's not going to have a very big percentage of the total. And this is just a big spectacle. I mean, this is, the media loves it, and we've become a spectacularized nation. Because
you can say that again.
Really, I mean, if it wasn't for this sort of sports-like presentation of this, and who's going to all the drama and all that, and Team Romney versus Team Santorum and all that.
When it used to be Team Mitt or Team Newt.
Team Newt.
Yeah, what happened to him?
He's going for Georgia.
Oh, that's his plan?
He says if they can't get their own home states, and that's why I wish I would have, oh, I don't know, last week I said that my wife and I applied for an absentee ballot, real easy to get.
You said this on the air,
and you can get either a Republican ballot, a Democratic Party ballot, or no primary ballot. So most people that are Democrats would say, well, I'll take nothing because there's no primary. All there is maybe some local issues and what have you. But we thought, because you can do that, we'll vote in the Republican primary. And if you think it's dirty pool, too effing bad.
Someone really took you to task.
Yeah, because the Republicans are so heavily involved in vote suppression that to mess with these people, this party funded by solely by billionaires. I know, the money is flowing. In fact, if you listen up to the interview I have at 1 a.m., Ari Berman of The Nation magazine talks about how now to combat the amount of money flowing into the Republican Party coffers, Obama's taking money from Wall Street as well. And that's the nature of this political system. It's run by money, right?
Yeah. Now, I didn't realize that. Is it Montana that passed laws that that corporations can't donate to political...
I don't think they could do that because this Supreme Court decision called Citizens United says that money is speech, except you and I talk, money swears. In fact, isn't that a Bob Dylan line? Money doesn't talk, it swears. I think so.
I think you're right this time.
Yeah. I've been guessing all around. We should get into some modern rock. I'm the master of classic rock. I kept repeating all the lines wrong, right?
The wrong bands.
313-298-WRIF. So you have this individual adherence to these twisted philosophies that people like Santorum or, the other people that would vote for him and what have you. But also, as an institution, the Republican Party and the corporate interests that it represents solely, corporate interests. Now, the Democratic Party represents corporate interests as well, but it also represents the interests of women, of liberals, of people that have a social conscience.
The environment.
There's a lot of things that the Democrats do and Obama does that are just awful. And if you go to any constituent group within the Democratic Party, they'll go, well, he's done some good things, but I just can't believe.
I mean, there's lists out there.
Yeah, there's lists out there. But what is going on with this education thing is that the Republicans want to destroy public education because they've always seen that, and to some extent correctly, as the bastion of modern and liberal thought. And
that's
as
amazing.
We see with their ideas on contraception, they want to go back to the Middle Ages about contraception for sure.
Oh, yeah.
So they oppose it ideologically, but also they want to, outsource it. They want it to be a corporation. They want us to go to schools run by one of their companies.
Yeah.
And the third and a very important thing to the politicians is they want to destroy the public sector teacher unions.
Yep.
Because they all support the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party is much, much better on education. And so if they can destroy these unions, which is one of their major goals, to take us back to the 19th century so they can get us all working at $3 an hour. People like Ron Paul don't even think there should be a minimum wage. Mm. At least he has the courage to say that. It's consistent with a philosophy he has. He actually thinks things will wind up for the better. However, the rest of them just think, hey, we can get people back to serfdom. We can screw the middle class.
We're not talking about riding the waves.
Yeah, exactly. So that's when you hear somebody like Rick Santorum talking about government is an anachronism, that is something old-fashioned, this is what it's all about. All right, let's continue on. Oh, here in our nation's capital, what did we just read? It was the country's most liberal area. It's Dalton. Dalton, hi, you're on the air. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF.
Toronto, Riff Rock, kick-ass rock. Anyway, dude, have you ever heard of West Point? It's one of the society competitors that breeds thought that we just proved. We stopped the Middle East from an invasion to continue into our legislature. Rick Santorum briefed the press on certain instances of Maharishis as well as sheiks in Wall Street industry by Boozle, who did have the communist lip. You understand, my good friend?
It is clear. It is completely clear. But go ahead. This is interesting. Are you with me? He hung up.
That was strange.
It was very strange. This is the strangest. This is the strangest show I've done in years.
I know, and it's really not a full moon.
Yeah, it isn't.
There's something going. There's something.
I don't
in
know
the
what's going
tonight.
On. The Maharishis. I don't get that.
Okay. Was he talking about the Washington Times? Wasn't that the? Well, that's the Moonies.
That's the Moonies. I have absolutely no idea what
the Maharishis. They have a place in Fairfield, Iowa.
Yeah, that's where. The Maharishi?
That's the one. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And, originally from Iowa.
That he can levitate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, it used to be, this is the Maharishi, what was the thing he was, what was the thing? Something in the morning, something at night. They gave you little
pillows.
Mantras.
Oh.
To say, and, you know, in a way, if you would stop, if I would, hey. Listen, I'm not going to lecture you. Let me, not, I don't mean you, Julian. I mean the audience. I mean, I should lecture myself. If each of us, 3 to 4 times a day, just if we're at our desk or we're in a shop or we're shopping or at home or whatever, mm-hmm. took 10 deep breaths and tried to release your stomach and release the tension in your
Feels good.
Yeah, it feels good. All of us would feel so much better. And usually when someone tells you this, I mean, you might just think this is nuts to do, but everyone who thinks this is a good idea, or maybe this doesn't happen to you, but I'd say, okay, I'm going to take 10 deep breaths. How long do you think that would take? It would probably take half a minute, 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Most of us, by the time we get to breath 4,
we're distracted.
Where our minds are going, and by the time we get to breath 6, we're going to go, well, I'll do this later.
I can't do the last 4. It's true. It's like trying to concentrate during a yoga class and stop the busyness in your head.
What is those? What anybody remind me of the Maharishi's thing? Something in the AM, something in the PM.
Okay.
Anyway, so there would be these shots, I think maybe beginning as early as the 70s or the 80s, where they would show the Maharishi levitating with his legs crossed above a platform. And there was always speculation of how did he do it. It was like maybe he was on a bed and he bounced, you know, like. But today, like with this program called Photoshop, you could do anything.
Hey, a few emails. I'll just do one at a time, and we do have a phone call. Open lines at 313-298-9743.
Okay, yeah, sure.
That's right. Terry wrote in and said, "Hey, Pete, wasn't the leader of the Mormons, Church of Jesus of Latter-day Saints, Warren Jeffs, recently convicted of rape?"
No, he was.
He's not leader of the Mormons, right?
No, he was a polygamous sect.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
that guy.
Had, yeah. And
scary.
That's what, like, Romney's grandfather moved to Mexico in order to keep a polygamous family together. And George.
Really?
Yeah. And George Romney, who was the governor of Michigan in the 1950s, was born in Mexico. So I don't know. I was just listening to Tom Hartman where someone asked, how could George Romney have run for president in 1968 if he's born in Mexico? But I think he was, I'm not sure.
Dennis wrote in, also said, I believe Patti Smith said it best, love is an angel disguised as lust. And this is all relative to our conversation early in the show about lust and contraception and sex. And
yeah, because we were quoting a Catholic priest that was said that if you're not having sex to procreate, then it becomes exploitive of the other person. And it just shows you the kind of trajectory of it. Why is it then the woman being exploited?
I mean, why is it? That's a good question.
I mean,
Dennis also said,
and I defended lust.
Yeah, and so did I.
Yeah.
Dennis also said, please bring back the Jeff Beck intro music.
Oh, yeah, Jesus. He's listening.
He's been listening for 30 plus years.
Ice Cream Cakes is the name of the song. Yeah. All right, here is Dave in Macomb Township. Dave says he's confused. What's up, Dave?
Hey, I'm sitting here listening to you. I haven't listened to you in a long time, but I'm trying to figure out where you're coming from on everything, because you, you're you're playing both sides of the fence at the same time.
How do you figure?
Well, you know, like you're talking about entitlement, you know. You don't believe that they should be taken away.
Right.
But on the other hand, if you don't take them away, who's going to pay for them? You know, my question to you is, if you want the entitlements around, well, why not make it voluntary, and why don't you just voluntarily surrender more of your own paycheck?
How about this? How about if we surrender the paycheck of the ultra-wealthy? How about instead of the taxes, Dave, that you and me and Jalene pay, and that it's transferred into the military-industrial complex, as long as we're going to have a society where income is so maldistributed that we don't let children suffer malnutrition, we don't let our aged go without proper, our seniors, our elders go without proper income and all that. How about that? How about reducing your taxes, my taxes, Jalene's taxes, and instead of financing this enormous war machine, this empire that stretches all across the world, we let that pay for it. Good idea?
I don't think so.
Why?
I'll tell you why. Yeah. I agree with you in the first part of your statement. I'm a firm believer that society is being run into the ground because professional athletes, movie actors, entertainers, are making millions upon millions of dollars.
It's not, you Dave. Know. Dave, you know, they make a lot of money, and they're in the
1%.
But it's the corporations,
and
it's
the
like,
military-industrial complex.
It's like ExxonMobil, who makes,
GM, who doesn't pay taxes.
Yeah, that's where.
Yeah, but Michael Jordan doesn't do anything for society.
Neither do
He does not contribute.
Well, I would say that Michael Jordan does more for society than ExxonMobil. Well, ExxonMobil is
polluting the planet.
Polluting the planet and the reason for wars.
Well, but ExxonMobil provides a service. Without ExxonMobil, we wouldn't be able to fuel the trucks.
Well, maybe we would have to use some alternative fuel.
Ooh.
And then instead of taking this poisonous substance, oil, for which we that's why we're in the Middle East. That's our so-called interest. That's why we're sending our billions and billions and billions of dollars over there.
Yeah,
sons
it's not
and
about
daughter.
Democracy.
Yeah. I think we disagree, but thank you. I appreciate it.
Andy wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I love that the governor of Washington signed marriage equality when Rick Santorum was campaigning in her state.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, there's, what is it, so now gay marriage is legal in Washington state?
I believe so.
Yeah, and it was just passed in New Jersey, but Governor Christie has said he's going to veto it.
Yeah.
And it was just passed in Maryland. So there's any number of states now. I mean, this is sort of like the 1960s in civil rights. That you drag these states, and it used to be the people, because if you would have, I mean, that was the whole thing with states' rights. If you would have polled the white people in Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Texas, all that, you know, do you support segregation? Among the white people, probably would have, they would have supported it probably, I don't know, 60-70%, like they do now.
Yeah.
But federal law and constitutional decisions through the Supreme Court made it illegal. So now the same thing's happening with gay rights. And there's still some people, I can't believe it. You know what they do? And,
you know what you do?
Yeah.
You think about it, you sicko.
Yeah. Right. So Jalene and I, often offer this challenge because you have these Republicans playing to these people that, for some reason or other, are so fearful of gays. How does heterosexual marriage suffer at all from gay marriage? I've been married a long time to a woman, and
and it hasn't changed that at all.
That gays can get married hasn't changed my life at all. And you can't object to it because you think it offends your concept of religious belief, because that's just your business, you know, and that it shouldn't say, because, hey, religious belief used to say that marriage between blacks and whites was illegal, and there were laws against it.
Yeah.
Up until the 1960s. And then where was it? Where was a country where Jews and Germans, they couldn't get married, you know?
Right.
So that's pretty bad for the state to make prohibitions against who can have essentially what's a legal contract. Like, I did not have a religious wedding. What am I talking about? I did have a religious wedding.
Yeah, you did.
I did. Yeah. All right. Well, there goes that argument. I was hoping you wouldn't bring that up. But for if you don't have them, you just get married.
If you could go back again, it would be not be a religious wedding.
Yeah.
I and did your it. Heart was not into it.
It wasn't. I did it for her father, and he didn't care anyways. He always hated me.
Did he really?
I thought I was a bum and a hippie.
Well, yeah.
The guy was. The guy. No, he didn't.
Come on.
The guy had some smarts.
No. Stop it.
All right. Let's get this call in. Here's Anonymous. You're not the Anonymous that does all the hacking and the websites, are you?
Oh, comps are evil.
What are?
Comps.
Comps.
Computers.
Oh, computers. I thought you meant comps when you get free complimentary tickets. I was going to say. Wait a minute. That's what we get here in radio. Anyway, so computers are evil.
No. Maharishi killed the 60s. You know how?
How?
He slept with all the Beatles' girlfriends.
Wow. So,
did you know that?
No.
I learned that from Drew and Mike.
Well, there's a source. And if you're listening from somewhere else, folks, Drew and Mike is the most listened to morning show. It's here on WRIF from whenever they get here till whenever they stop.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right. So, I mean, wait a minute. He didn't sleep with all their girlfriends.
All of them.
All
what?
Of them.
Yes.
And the Beatles probably didn't care.
Yeah.
Wait. I lost a John, imagine John Lennon lithograph. Hello?
You lost it?
In the contest, you know, but.
What's a lithograph?
Oh, they had a contest. Yeah.
Who did? Drew and Mike?
What I do have?
What?
Is a collector's card from, I got from Tony's Junk Shop over on Ford Street in Wyandotte. And,
that's the same guy here.
Is it?
He snowed us because I noticed the.
Here's Steve and Troy. God. Steve, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, what's happening?
Nothing much, man.
The being born in Mexico and running for president, one has to be a natural born U.S. citizen.
Right.
Which doesn't mean they have to be born within these borders. It just means they have to be a U.S. citizen at the time of their birth.
So, in other words, if my parents had been in, I don't know, Canada.
Let's say they were on vacation in Italy
right.
And you were born. You'd be eligible to be.
So old George Romney Willard's father, Mitt's father, was eligible.
Yeah, and I wish all people, because I'm single, I wish all guys were gay, because then all the women would be there for me.
There's a theory.
I don't know. You know, women are getting tougher and tougher. That's why it's hard for men. He left. That's why men, it's hard for to deal with them. You know, when they used to just go, yeah.
You know, not anymore.
Not anymore. Man, they are tough.
Yeah, we are tough. Got an email from Aaron at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and he said, hey, Peter and Julian, a few Romney definitions from urbandictionary.com, okay?
Right.
So the first one is Romney, which means a verb, to defecate in terror. This colloquialism originates in the infamous and widely publicized 1983 incident where Mitt Romney strapped his Irish setter to the roof of his car whilst driving to Canada, causing the terrified dog to defecate. And let's see, also to defecate in fear, especially while atop a vehicle's cargo rack in a dog crate.
That's a little specific.
I like this one. Romney boating. You know what motor boating is, Peter?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I don't know what motorboating
okay.
is.
Okay. Well, I'll explain to you in the commercial break that we have to take soon. Romney boating. Standing between, this might help you. Standing between two boobs on a debate stage and prattling on like a 5-year-old making engine noises.
Hey, here's Jerry wrote in. I forgot about this. Now, whose guy was this? Was this Santorum's? In fact, we ought to move on to the aides to these guys as well, because I think it was one of Santorum's people.
I thought it was one of Romney's people, the Arizona one?
No. This was a guy who said that the best birth control was a Bayer aspirin. He said all the women had to do to stop getting pregnant was hold an aspirin between their legs.
What? Oh, so it keeps their legs
yeah,
together?
Yeah, this is the old...
Wow!
Yeah, so he's gone.
That is horrible.
Yeah.
These guys... They just can't help themselves.
No, they can't. They're back. You know, that. I mean, women are in the 21st century. Guys are like in 1950s Playboy.
Yeah, no doubt. And then a lib in South Carolina said, Ain't it amazing how the U.S. GOP is listening to the Pope now? G.W. Bush didn't listen to him about the death penalty or the Iraq War.
No, that's the seamless garment is not there, which is no war, no capital punishment, no abortion. If you say that to me, I'd start taking you a little serious, and particularly if you say, those are my beliefs, I act on them, but I don't want the state to enforce the, my concept mm-hmm. of birth and when a child is conceived through the state. Other than that, I just think you're, I don't know. Anyway, well, let me see. Did you, do we want to look at this one? That's lived in South Carolina. Okay, we're going to take a break. We got a half hour left, and then we're going to do a couple of very interesting interviews, including how the big money is flowing in. And we'll also talk about, as Jalene said, Mitt Romney, co-chair of Arizona. This is a story that'll knock your socks off.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
So bad, the only one who will hang out with me is my dear this.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much and welcome back. And hey, I haven't even talked once about my website tonight, have I?
Wow, you really have.
Because we do
Peter.
So much Facebook now. I mean, some people have said that websites, man, they're so 20th century.
Yeah, but you can't put as much information on your Facebook page that you have on your website.
Yeah. And you can go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, and there's some good stuff there. And, like, I didn't write it. I'm not bragging. It's just copy and paste.
It's information.
Yeah. So they have the whole thing about dog lovers against Romney. Something like that. They got the Mutt Romney Blues.
That is a good one.
Yeah.
I like that one.
And the whole details on Crate Gate.
It's fabulous.
Also, all the information about the Reason Rally. It's the largest secular gathering in world history. It's going to be atheists, agnostics, and what do they call it? Like ag curious.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, if you just want to.
Kind of like bi-curious?
Yeah, something like that. And essentially, it's going to be a big keep religion where it belongs, in the houses of worship, not out in the public square. There is also, when we're talking about the idea that Rick Santorum and the rest of them condemning, not abortion, they always do that, but contraception. There's a John Stewart bit on my website called The Vagina Ideologues. And that comes, there was a play for a long time called The Vagina Monologues. And it was women talking about their thing.
Their thing.
Yeah, right. So that's on there. And also, and I forgot completely about the group Anonymous, that are these hackers that supported WikiLeaks. And these are the people that that gave out all this information from U.S. websites. And they've been taking down sites of malefactors, and they took down this one from, let me see if I can get to it real quickly. They took it down from Combined Systems Incorporated. Combined Systems, their little, the jobs they provide for us Americans, and they've stole personal information regarding clients and employees.
Wow.
And you would say, well, that's not very nice. But it's a U.S. security company whose tear gas has been used against Egyptian demonstrators.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I knew that sounded familiar.
And they've done, what they do essentially is to, this company is sell weapons of suppression to dictatorships around the world. Now, this goes through the United States government, and this goes through now the Democratic administration. Mm-hmm. It goes through the Republican administrations. And I heard our pal, Mike Malloy, great talk show host, talking about, he said, how do these guys live with themselves?
Yeah, they see, that's what I was just going to say.
So if you're looking at Bahrain, by the way, which has a big U.S. naval base there and has been particularly repressive, not as bad as Syria, but which is being supplied by the Russians, not us in this case. And very, very harsh, tear gas, killings, imprisoning, torture, all of that. And some of it is used to tear gas. So, now we have television. We see all this right in front of our faces.
Yeah, well, not as much in the United States press, in the United States media.
They've done stuff on Bahrain, but, I mean, not a lot. You're right. So, I mean, what do these guys do? They're watching television with their families, and they say, hey, dear, look, they're using tear gas. I was part of the process. Or do they just try to do what the cognitive dissonance,
It's got to be.
Yeah, they just don't connect up what their acts provide, or I need a job.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very possible. All right, I'm still going to get to Romney's aid, but let me get, oh, no, it's Anonymous again. We don't want Anonymous again. Never mind.
He's very busy. Yeah.
Here's the deal with the Romney official.
One call per show. That's our rule.
Now, remember, what was his first name? Anthony Weiner.
Yes.
He was the Democratic Congressman. Wienergate, right, because he kept showing his wiener. It was covered, but it was pretty obvious. It was there. Online, neath his undershorts, and he was texting.
Was it mostly texting?
Yeah, or some or emails and all that.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was a very, very outspoken liberal Democrat. And it just crushed a lot of people that they lost him as a voice, and he resigned, which I think was a total error.
Yeah.
Because, never, oh my God. Maybe, well, I just, see, I, you know, I never read. Wait a minute, I'll get back to this in a second. It says, line one is not the same weirdo that was calling.
Oh, Peter.
The second anonymous really sounded like he was a real caller.
Okay, call back.
Call back.
We apologize. But this, we're not used to this anonymous thing. Yeah. People always just give the name. I mean,
but
feel
Athena,
free.
He may be just putting on a different voice.
Yeah, because he put on a different voice last time.
Yeah.
He was pretty good at
anyway,
it, too.
Anyway, so let's get back to Wiener and Wienergate. So he resigned, and there was a special election. People were really outraged, and they actually voted in a Republican in a heavily Democratic district in Queens, was it, or Brooklyn, one or the other. Anyway, and the guy will probably be voted out, and the Democrat will be voted back in this year.
Yeah.
But, you know, the guy is not making, he never is publicly saying, I follow the Bible and all of this. He was just a doofus.
With a pregnant wife.
He was a personal doofus. But what the hell does that have to do with his politics? People always use the example that in France, that when an ex-president, Mitterrand, died, his wife was there sitting next
with
with his mistress, holding hands, and they're both crying.
Yeah. Look at Sarkozy. He's got the hot model wife, you know.
And he's got a babe on the side?
No, I'm just saying, you know, that's kind of modern. Yeah,
that's kind of French.
Actress.
Yeah. But the
singer.
The point being is that Democrats don't make any pretensions about adhering to family values and then get caught whoring in New Orleans like this Republican Senator Vitter or any number of things. And like I think I've always said, is that Clinton, when they said, you know, were you having sex with Monica Lewinsky, who's back, by the way, in a documentary.
Yeah, there's a documentary called Clinton on PBS.
Yeah, and Bill Clinton should have said, you know what, I'm not going to answer any questions about
none
my personal
business.
Life. Like, look at John Kennedy, and this thing came out that this intern, first day on the job, he's 42, she's 19, and he's banging her, and he's banging her for years.
Yeah,
you know?
that's new.
And his wife's
new
bed.
Info.
And, you know, what to me, I'm thinking, so what?
I know.
You know. They didn't call him Mattress Jack for nothing.
You know, and he was getting some tension off of his, you know.
But here, when you make these pretensions at religiosity and this high moral calling and all that, well, then you get there's a special set of standards. So Paul Babu, wasn't there a Babu the elephant?
Is it Tarzan or something?
No, I think it's just a book about
The Jungle Book.
Kids book, yeah. He was a popular politician in Arizona, stepped down from his role as co-chair of Mitt Romney's Arizona campaign after allegations that he threatened to deport a former boyfriend. That's like in boy. This is like guy and boyfriend. So here is this Republican, ex-military guy, hardline cop. He's a sheriff of Pinal County, southeast of Phoenix, and he's really tough on illegal immigration. So he's doing some guy, which for a Democrat, it's okay. Who cares? You know.
Is he married?
No. That would be the full piece. That would be a typical Republican.
Yeah,
right?
I know.
That would be a typical Republican. But at least, and actually he admitted to being gay, which was so
refreshing.
But Mr. Babu emailed explicit photographs of himself in underwear and naked below the waist to an anonymous man who they're calling Jose, who he met on a website called Adam for Adam.
I love it.
And then in one photo published in the New Times website, that's the paper there, the New Times website, Mr. Babu is shown taking a self-portrait in only his underwear. And that's like, that's what Anthony Weiner did.
That is
so
what he did.
So I'm thinking, you know, okay, I just got an email from somebody, you know, from a girl, you know, thing, I really like your show. You got any photos for me? And I go, oh, I will take a photograph of me in my underwear.
Oh, my God.
And so what goes through my mind? Anthony Weiner.
Yeah.
I mean, how come it doesn't occur to this schmuck?
I know. Or clearly he hasn't been paying attention.
Yeah.
But so he resigned.
So, he resigned. The Phoenix New Times reported the allegations of a 34-year-old Mexican man whom they identified only as Jose He said that when he refused to sign an agreement that he would never mention his relationship with Mr. Babu, which he said lasted for years, the sheriff and his lawyers tried to intimidate him with threats of deportation.
Yeah, I know. Amazing.
So this is typical. This is typical Republican. You know, threats and all that. This, you know what? That actually constitutes blackmail. I'm sorry. Is it blackmail or extortion? No, it's extortion.
It's extortion.
That actually is a crime. That if you try, by threat, try to make people alter or their behavior or conform to the behavior you're demanding of them, that's extortion. This guy should be indicted. So here's, you know, this is Mitt Romney's co-chair. I'm sure he didn't know anything about it. He says the allegations are absolutely completely false, except for the issues that refer to me as being gay, because that's the truth. I am gay.
Well, good on him.
Can you know that? What if some, you know, people dial by?
Yes. Peters, that wasn't
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
No. You know, I got to go back to this dogs against Romney thing real quick.
Sure.
Because I just ran into something. I forgot I was going to bring this up. There were protesters at the dog show in New York.
Right.
Dogs against Romney.
Right.
Because Romney
is mean.
Romney is mean because Romney, and has admitted that he did a 12-hour road trip with his dog strapped to the top of the car in a crate. So they had, like a mock-up of it. And the cops stopped him.
Really?
Yeah. This is actually the Littleton, Colorado one. I'm sorry. Littleton, Colorado police yesterday stopped Dogs Against Romney PAC member for having a dog crate on the roof of the car. So for these 12 hours, no one stopped Mitt Romney.
Oh, you mean they stopped him like a stop?
Yeah, and it was only a stuffed dog inside the crate.
I never understood.
Suspected animal abuse.
Wow. Well, you know what? Could this sink Romney?
Well, I'll tell you. If I were a Republican, shudder the thought, and I liked Romney, if I heard this, that I'd be out.
You know, I'm changing. Everybody said that it's a lock for Romney because Republican establishment thinks he's the one that could
win.
But you know what? Great numbers of evangelicals and real conservatives, you know, because Mitt is a Massachusetts moderate for real, what Newt calls him.
He's trying not to be.
He was pro-choice and...
There was universal... He created a universal health care system in his state.
Romney Care! Yeah, exactly, which was an exact, duplication
of what Obama's doing.
Yeah. So now it really looks like... people could be switching to Santorum because he will bring out all the right wingers en masse.
I hope he gets in there because they're going to just have a heyday with him. You know, the guy's a nutbag.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice? I mean, it's just, but what happens is the political discourse is going to become so incredibly toxic.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, think about elections going way back. Bush and, what was his name? Kerry.
Oh, yeah.
Or Bush and Gore or Clinton and, what was that guy's name? You know, the guy with that hurt his arm in World War II or...
Oh, Dole?
Yeah, Dole.
Yeah, the one with the pen.
The one with the pen.
I met him once, and I almost reached for the wrong arm, wrong hand.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, that's the pen hand.
Now we've entered this new phase that it really is. We have this moderate center-right president.
Yeah.
We're talking about
Barack Obama here.
Yeah, because he doesn't even really qualify as an authentic liberal, in my estimation, against this far right-wing character, Santorum, if that's what happens. People that were before operated only on the far obscure margins of American political discourse in the world. I mean, these people were all always there, I mean, saying these insane things, but they didn't see the light of day. Because everybody knew they were crazy and didn't represent anybody. Mm-hmm. And you know what? They still don't represent anybody. I just saw this poll.
Just themselves.
Yeah. That, you know, the Gallup takes these polls, who's a conservative, Gallup is. And,
yeah.
You know, you can, and they use scientific methods, but observation always kind of changes what's being measured. But whatever. So they say that the conservatives are the largest coherent group in American society. They represent like 40%.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, moderates and liberals outnumber.
Right.
But one of the things that they found out other pollsters do is when they ask people specifically, you know, it's self-defined. Are you a conservative? Oh, yeah, I'm a conservative. And,
oh.
And what it might mean is the guy wants to keep his arsenal. But on the other hand, he belongs to a union. He thinks there should be national health care. He thinks, on and on and on. And what have you, right?
Yeah.
So it's not even clear. And when you really go issue...
When you really go issue to issue, well, I was going to, while you're coughing,
and wow, get, sorry.
Do you need some water? You good?
Go ahead.
Okay. David from Washington State wrote in and said, hey, Peter and Julene, as always, he loves our show. And he says, we have the best lefty talking chat he's ever heard.
Wow. That's great. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
But the point being, when you go issue by issue with the American people, it comes down so hard left. It's unimaginable.
Yeah.
Because for one thing, I think it is, because I got two interviews coming up. One is with Ari Berman from The Nation magazine called Herding Donkeys. And he discusses the way money is flowing into super PACs and how it distorts politics. And when you start asking the American people issue by issue, it comes out totally left-wing. And what's called left-wing, and I'm saying, why? The people that want a fair society, that want tolerance, that want social justice, that don't want to take away everybody's money. Because, you know, if you say to people, well, should we eat the rich? Should we, you know, take them out of the castles into the ditch? They go, no. You know, people, that they believe in meritocracy, you know, as a principle. But it shouldn't be that people are buying, you know, $1,200 pairs of shoes while other people don't even have enough to... you know, to eat.
For BOGO.
Yeah. For what?
Buy one, get one free at Payless.
Oh.
But you're right about that.
Yeah.
You know?
So if it came down to it, Santorum and all the rest of them are missing the boat. I mean, well, they have to say that to get the nomination,
to be
sure.
They just want votes. That's
but
it.
The person that's
they
really
won't say anything.
Yeah, the person that's really making the mistake is Barack Obama, because he could be so far more to the left and get so much more support.
Yeah, that's where he's disappointed a lot of people with his corporatist ways.
One of the things that has to be careful about, you know, one. I've heard people, when Bush was the president, they said that, well, Bush is our commander-in-chief. Well, he's not the commander-in-chief, nor is Barack Obama, the commander-in-chief of the American people. He's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces.
Yeah.
And the founding fathers, which I don't know how they figured this out. I mean, I know it was their experience with living as in an English colony. But they knew there had to be civilian authority. For the armed forces. It was very, very critical, and that's why they appointed him that. They did not want what happens in other countries. So you have now this going on. This is from the New York Times. As the United States turns increasingly to special operations forces to confront developing threats scattered around the world, the nation's top special operations officer, a member of the Navy SEALs who oversaw the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, is seeking new authority to move his forces faster and outside of the normal Pentagon deployment channels. You go, whoa.
Yeah, that's what is that? Scary.
The officer, Admiral William H. McRaven, who leads the Special Operations Command, is pushing for a larger role for his elite units to have traditionally operated in dark corners of American foreign policy. The plan would give him more autonomy to position his forces and their warfighting equipment where intelligence and global events indicate they are most needed. Now, one of the things in decision-making people really value is flexibility. And so what they're essentially saying is that we we don't have the same kind of warfare that we used to. And in fact, it's not warfare at all. If anything, it's really police operations. So
yeah,
you have these
taking over.
Yeah, you have these ultra right religious gangs that that want to strike back against the U.S. because of our
treatment of
civilians. Yeah, I mean, not that that gives them any right to do that any more than it gives the United States the right
but
to.
But that's the impetus.
Yeah, that's their rationalization. It would allow the Special Operations Forces to expand their presence in regions where they have not operated in large numbers for the past decade, especially in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. So I got a good idea. Let's get all of these people, you know, our Special Operations folks, doing in these other continents what they're doing in the Middle East, and instead of just Islamists, radical Islamists, a small percentage of people that adhere to that religion,
yeah,
totally pissed off at us. Well, I shouldn't say that. I would say great numbers of them are pissed off. It's only a small, infinitesimal minority.
Act on it.
Act out it. Yeah. Let's get that same impetus going in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. The idea is, and just so, you know, I don't know why I have to frame it in these terms, but just so, you know, it's not just some radical commie, idea. This is essentially what Ron Paul says as well. He's a Republican. He's got, so there's great support for this among the American people, both on the left and that sector of the right that's occupied by Ron Paul. So yeah, occupy Ron Paul. There you go.
Well, right. Yes, a lot of people are.
To dismantle the empire. There was a caller later was talking about how we're, you know, these entitlements and all that.
Yeah.
That's how you finance them all. You know, as long as we're going to be returning.
I hate that they call them entitlements. It sounds like these people are up on a
well, you know, that's
pedestal.
Interesting. Remember, we've talked about how the Republicans have occupied language, how they they have anti-choice, compulsory pregnancy, and they call it pro-life.
Yeah.
They talk about unions as being special interests and don't apply it to corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once I had a whole list of these things. Oh, yeah, right to work. That's another.
Yeah, right.
You know, rather than it's a right to bust
no
unions.
No child left behind.
Yeah, yeah, all of this. So, well.
Peter, someone wrote in and said, please get on Twitter, that we should have a Twitter account.
Yeah, you should.
I knew that's what you were going to say.
Yeah.
Maybe. I'll think
Follow
about it.
Follow me. Isn't there some song from the 40s?
Well, there's the one from the 80s.
Called Follow Me?
Yeah. I can't remember who.
No. But it was like, anyway, you want to do that?
Maybe. I'm
set
gonna
up
think,
a Twitter
I'll
account?
Think about it.
Yeah.
I set up one for myself 2 years ago, and I haven't done one post. So I don't know if that's a good sign.
All right, dear friends, thank you for listening. Thank you for calling. And stay tuned. A couple of interesting interviews, besides the one with Ari Berman talking about how money flowing to super PACs is distorting politics. Also, Michael Yates, who has this incredible anthology of Wisconsin Uprising. Remember that all that was happening? Labor fighting back. And if we all ever want models of how we can stop this race to the bottom that's on the agenda of the right wing, we saw it in Wisconsin. All right, so we'll talk next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, if you've been away from your television, and many of us never are, you don't know how many ads there are for the Republican primary that we see every single day. And this is kind of just a smidge of what has appeared in other states. And, you know, we wonder, well, who's paying for all this? I think most of us have a general idea that it's not you and me taking $5 out of our pocket or anything like that, and that really it is the wealthy who, and corporations and to some extent unions who fuel what we see as so-called political advertisements. But what does this all do to democracy? I don't think any of us think it's real good. And I want to talk about a very important Supreme Court decision that allowed this flood of money into the electoral system, but also who it is as well. Joining me is Ari Berman. He is a contributing writer for The Nation magazine, a publication I would highly recommend. You can go to thenation.org. I believe, and he's also an investigative journalism fellow at the Nation Institute. And he printed a book, published a book in 2010 called Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. It's just out in paper. We're reaching Ari Berman in New York City. Thanks for joining us on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Hey, I didn't even want to say this new article that appeared in TomDispatch.com because the figure in it has so many zeros, it flummoxed me. So what are you calling the title of your article?
Sure. The article is called the 0.00000063% election, and the subhead is how the politics of the super rich became American politics. And so we think of politics as being dominated by the 1% or the 1% of the 1%, but it's actually the 0.00000063%, because if you look at who has given the money to these super PACs that are running all these ads in Michigan and all across the country in this Republican primary, 80% of the money has come from 196 donors who have given $100,000 or each, and that's how I got the figure. That's the title of my piece.
Well, yeah, you know, it's. I think we even ought to maybe start at the beginning. I think things like PACs and super PACs have almost become proper nouns. Explain to us what a PAC is, even beginning with what it stands for.
Sure. A PAC stands for a political action committee, and essentially these are entities that can raise more money than a candidate per se, and they function as essentially an extension of political campaigns. Now, super PACs are an extension of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision in January 2010. And what makes these super PACs different than regular PACs is that regular PACs could only accept $5,000 donations. Super PACs can accept unlimited donations. Someone can give them $1 million. Someone could give them $100 million if they wanted. And they can run ads against or for a candidate. Now, what they supposedly can't do is coordinate directly with the candidate. But we all know that that, in fact, is a sham, because we have a situation now where Republican candidates like Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich are actually speaking before their super PACs. They just can't say directly, give money to my campaign, but they can say pretty much anything else they want. Same with the Obama administration now, which has also gotten in the game. Cabinet officials from the Obama White House are actually going to be speaking before a pro-Obama super PAC that they are theoretically, legally prohibited from coordinating with. So you see how much of a murky affair this whole thing really is.
Well, and now most of us just can't stand seeing these ads over and over again, and I can't imagine that that people were, like, say, in Florida, where there were so many of them, were anything but, you know, screaming, no, I can't stand it. But your book that's just come out in paper, Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics, shows your on one side of the divide. Most of us are. I am, certainly. And so, okay, you can put all this money into the game so all these rich fat cats can do it. And our labor unions, of which I'm a member, can do that as well. Seems kind of equal.
Well, it's not equal. And let me just say, as far as my book, Herding Donkeys, goes, it's about the Democratic Party. It's not an argument for the Democratic Party. What it is an argument for, though, is the type of grassroots campaign that propelled Barack Obama to the White House, which I and many others found very inspiring. The fact that Obama brought all these new people into the political process in many different ways in many different states. I thought that was an amazing development in 2008. What I have found distressing subsequently is how that grassroots movement has been pushed aside and how the 1% of the 1% have taken over American politics. And I think the concentration of wealth in so few hands now in the 2012 election, essentially a system we have of legalized bribery, is something that should distress you whether you are a Republican or a Democrat, because what's happening in the 2012 election is fundamentally anti-democratic.
Well, what about what I asked? They said it seems equal. You got rich guys like Sheldon Adelson giving money, millions of dollars, to Newt Gingrich. And then we could have, like, the Michigan State AFL giving money to the Democratic Party. Seems
Well, it's never going to be equal. I think we all know the state of the labor movement in Michigan and elsewhere. The labor unions are never going to have as much money as the corporations will have. It's never going to happen. If you look at the super PAC funding thus far, Republicans are absolutely crushing Democrats in terms of the amount of money they've raised from super PACs and the amount of money they've raised from big donors. So it's unlikely Democrats can win at this game, and if they do win at this game, they are going to take money from a lot of the very same people that Republicans take money from, people like Wall Street, which is what happened in the Clinton era, and the unions in Michigan are probably going to be pushed to the side, not become more important.
Also, as a union member, I mean, the idea that my dues have to be used in part for political campaigns is not, I don't think, the best expenditure of them.
I don't think union members are going to be very happy about their money going to super PACs. I have never taken a poll of union members on that, but it doesn't exactly strike you as the kind of thing that's standing up for the little guy.
No, indeed. My guest is Ari Berman, and his book, Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics, has just been issued in paper. And who's published that? I didn't ask you
It
that.
Came out in hardcover by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and it came out in paperback by Picador.
Okay. Now, I never understood the mentality of the rich. I mean, why people like the Koch brothers, that's K-O-C-H, folks, always worth a Google, why do they want to make more money? I don't understand it. They own everything now, yet they intervene in these political battles, financing the Tea Party, and whereas like David Koch, I mean, I used to think of him as the guy that helped build Lincoln Center in New York or gave all this money for prostate cancer research. Suddenly, you know, he's this right-wing political partisan that people curse his name. Why wouldn't this guy just accept being loved, although maybe this is beyond...
Peter, you know how capitalism works. You can't just make money. You have to make more money every year for your shareholders, or you're not considered a success. And the Koch brothers are making strategic investments by giving all this money. They're trying to repeal regulations they don't like from the Environmental Protection Agency. They're trying to buy influences of other sectors of the government. Part of it is motivated by whatever they believe, their ideology, but a lot of it is also motivated by self-interest. And again, this is why I think the Democratic Party is ultimately going to be able to win the super PAC battle, because the money and the influence is more on the right than it is on the left. And yes, you will have Hollywood people like Jeffrey Katzenberg who will give $1 million to the Democratic Party because they care about one thing or the other, but you're much more likely to have a situation where if you look at Mitt Romney's super PAC, you have 10 guys from Wall Street giving $1 million each, and they are buying influence. They want the Dodd-Frank bill repealed. They want a whole host of regulations gutted. And if those people start giving money to the Democratic Party and to the Obama campaign, they're also going to demand things as well. And we're going to have a situation where corporations have even more influence in the political process than they already do.
Well, the Obama reelection committee has already started soliciting, something they said they weren't going to do, but they, Walter Mosley's book, Always Outnumbered, Always Outgunned. The idea was, if we don't go to the fat cats, we're going to be in a lesser position. And so they're realistically almost forced to do so, no?
They are forced to do so, but they're also making a deal with the devil. It's hard to imagine them raising all this money from the so-called fat cats and then turning around and fighting for the 99%, or more like it, fighting for the 0.9999937%, to refer back to the title of my article. So the question is, Obama might need that money to get reelected, but what is he compromising to do so? What promises is he making? What won't he be able to do, or what is he not willing to fight for in his second term? Will he make overturning the Citizens United decision a central focus point of his second term after he's just fundraised for a year under that system? I mean, he might. I'm not saying he won't, but it just makes it harder for him to do so.
All right, Berman, if you would, review for us the Citizens United case and maybe that the Supreme Court decided, and maybe even put it in a longer historical perspective and what was allowed and what this decision opened the floodgates to.
Sure. So It was really a response to the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform of 2002. And what that did is it banned unlimited soft money donations. So you could give a lot of money back in the 90s to the Democratic Republican Party. You had situations where people were giving 100,000, half a million bucks to the party. And that's where a lot of the fundraising scandals of the 1990s came in. So we had the McCain-Feingold Act to counteract that. What it did is it got rid of these soft money donations, and it allowed the parties to raise more in quote-unquote hard money, upping the limits that you could give to a candidate or to a political action committee. A lot of people on the right didn't like that. They wanted to be able to give as much as they wanted. So a conservative lawyer named James Bopp brought a challenge to the Supreme Court against McCain-Feingold. No one really thought it was going to go anywhere because it was essentially arguing that money equaled speech. And the Supreme Court, in a pretty amazing precedent, turned around and said, yeah, we basically are going to gut McCain-Feingold and replace it with this system where you can give as much money as you want to these new political action committees. And that's now where super PACs come from. So the political system was pretty broken before the Citizens United decision. And after that decision, it just got a whole lot worse in terms of the amount of money flooding the political system and the basic idea that an individual can give whatever he wants to influence American elections. And not only that, but, and I don't want to get too complicated in terms of the explanation, but not only are there super PACs, there's also these organizations called 501c4s that are under their tax code, which are essentially social welfare organizations that are tax exempt and dedicated to promoting the common good. They can raise unlimited amounts of money and they don't have to disclose their donors at all. So we're seeing a lot of money flood in not only to the super PACs, but also to the 501c4s, which right now are basically functioning as secret slush funds for billionaires.
Well, you know, you hit on a good point. You said not, I can't remember how you phrase it, but essentially saying that things weren't great before the Citizens United case and that the Supreme Court decided. And it's sort of like, you know, like in Casablanca, there's gambling here. I'm shocked. So we hadn't solved the problem of money and big money, particularly influencing politics before Citizens United. Were we on the way at all? I mean, usually this has to go fairly incremental. Was there a hope that this, but that was thrown to the curb with Citizens United, or you know what I'm asking?
There was a movement of people in the Congress to try to incentivize politicians to seek small donations, because right now they have no incentive to seek small donors because they could raise money from big donors instead, and that was the case before Citizens United. So the idea was to create some sort of public matching fund system that would really work in the 21st century and give people an incentive to seek small donors. Instead, we went in the complete opposite direction. So if you imagine before 2010, the campaign finance system was sort of like you're 40 feet underwater. Well, now with the Citizens United decision, we're 100 feet underwater. We're either, you know what I mean? We're just further and further from getting to the top. And so what you have to do if you care about a democracy and you don't want political power concentrated in so few hands is you have to first figure out how to overturn that decision, and then you have to replace it with something better. And I think that something better would be the Fair Elections Now Act that is before the Congress.
Well, could you do that? I mean, if the Supreme Court has decided that money is speech, how you would almost need a constitutional amendment, which I know some people have proposed.
One idea is a constitutional amendment, which would probably take a very long time. Another is to get a different Supreme Court. I mean, it's very possible that if Barack Obama was reelected and he appointed different justices, particularly if you flipped a conservative justice with a liberal justice, that they could reexamine that decision. They're not necessarily going to overturn it entirely, but the decision itself was based on very sketchy precedent, according to a lot of legal scholars. And so it's not hard to imagine that you could, number one, change how that decision was interpreted or enforced. But then also Obama, what he could be doing right now is putting some teeth behind the Federal Election Commission and not only enforcing the law as it is, but really cracking down on these 501c4 organizations that are raising unlimited secret amounts of money and basically say, you guys aren't operating as social welfare organizations, you guys are operating as extensions of super PACs and political campaigns, and that's not what the tax code was intended for. But he's not doing that now, and I'm not quite sure why.
Well, it's pretty difficult, too, to ask legislators who are the recipients of all this money, who increasingly depend upon it in both parties, to talk about abolishing it. The idea that, for instance, that we could pass a law that would say, all right, we're going to have a month of campaigning, you know, in October. It's all going to be on television and at, you know, specific times, and guys can go out and make all the speeches they want. And then, boom, we're going to vote in November. That would money is would not be allowed to be inserted into campaigns, would probably take care of it all. But that's about as much as chance right now as Newt Gingrich's colony on the moon, right?
Yeah, I mean, maybe we can have special elections on the moon that are publicly financed and only last for a month. But, I mean, essentially, we are stuck with this system. If we get rid of Citizens United, we're just going to go back to a failed status quo. So we do have to think about how to improve it. I think one of the consequences of the 2012 election, however, is going to be the fact that people are going to be so disgusted by the TV ads, so disgusted by the super PAC money, they're going to know without doubt that the politicians are bought off. They are going to demand bolder solutions. And politicians may not do this based on their own altruism, but politicians also respond to public pressure. And so if there is a lot of pressure on the political leaders to do something about it, then there might be some changes. They're not revolutionary changes, but they could make some improvements upon a broken system, one of which would just be to pass the Disclose Act, which would make it so that we know who all these donations are coming from.
All right, Berman, in the article that you published at TomDispatch.com, I got to get 63% election, how the politics of the super rich became American politics. You talk about the campaign in Florida, I believe it is, where the Romney and his allies ran 13,000 TV ads in Florida, and Newt Gingrich only got 200. Are these ads effective? I mean, after a while, already people are saying, can you believe that Romney ad with him going to the Detroit Auto Show? How many times I've seen that? I mean, people, of course, you know, maybe it's who I'm talking to, but are these ads even effective?
Negative advertising in particular is a loathsome business, but political consultants will tell you that it is effective, which is why we keep seeing negative ads. And it wasn't just that Romney outspent Gingrich 13,000 to 200 in terms of TV ads. It was also the fact that two-thirds of those TV ads attacked Gingrich. So they really did help sink his campaign. They weren't the only factor. The fact that he had two very bad debate performances in Florida the week before certainly didn't help matters, not to mention all the baggage he had before that. But money does get you pretty far, and it's interesting. In Michigan, the Rick Santorum versus Mitt Romney contest has been phrased something like a David versus Goliath contest. But remember, Rick Santorum has his own billionaire backing him. So in this sense, even the Davids now need to have their own billionaires to be able to compete. And not only that, but no matter what happens in Michigan, I'm skeptical about Santorum's ability to compete on Super Tuesday when there are 10 states voting and when the money and the organization really comes in handy, the ability to have TV ads, the ability to have campaign offices, to have an infrastructure in place in all these different states. Romney has that, and Santorum doesn't have that, and I do think that could be the deciding factor in the primary.
All right, Berman, some people have said that the only thing that's keeping Romney as the projected winner of the Republican nomination is Newt Gingrich. If Gingrich was to drop out, all of his votes or the majority of his votes would go to Santorum, and that Romney is so disliked with the increasingly right-wing base of the Republican Party that Santorum would wind up to be the candidate.
It's possible that's the case. Gingrich in certain states is polling so badly that he's not even having an impact on the race. So you have to look at the states where Gingrich is polling well. In some of the socially conservative southern states, there's no doubt that that's true. But once again, I bring this back to super PACs. Gingrich has gotten virtually all the money to his super PAC has come from one donor, Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas casino magnate. He has given two $5 million donations to the Gingrich super PAC, and he said he may give more. Adelson has also said in recent days that he really doesn't like Rick Santorum. He doesn't want Rick Santorum to be the nominee. So if you're Newt Gingrich and you're getting all this money from a backer who doesn't like Santorum, can Gingrich actually drop out of the race? Or does he have to stay in and attack Santorum because that's what his super PAC sugar daddy wants? And so even though Gingrich clearly favors Santorum over Romney in the grand scheme of things, I would look for Newt to stay in for a while as long as he has that super PAC money, and probably to start attacking Santorum more directly, because those are the strings that come attached with the money nowadays.
And there's an excellent article in the current issue of The Nation. You go to thenation.com by Ari Berman, my guest's colleague, Eric Alterman, of the role of Sheldon Adelson. Yeah. Quite incredible. I mean, in fact, you'd think that we'd all gone past the point of being shocked by any of this, right? I usually tell people, I'm shocked you're shocked. I mean, this is, you know, people say that this is the system not working, where other people say this is the system. And I mean, I think we've kind of established that. What are the political forces? You mentioned a couple of them in passing that are actually, in motion that are going to change all this. I just ran into a guy here at work. He said, I hate all those guys, Obama, Romney, everything. You know, people are going to begin to disengage again because they're going to feel powerless.
Yeah, I mean, and that is one of the consequences of political advertising, according to the political science literature, is that it does lead to a, quote, political implosion of apathy and withdrawal, and that could be one of the consequences of the whole super PAC era as well, is that we just get a democracy that's bought and sold to the highest bidder and a very demobilized electorate, although I do think it would be a mistake for people to just throw up their hands and withdraw and not feel like they could do anything about it. One thing that people can do is become aware of the Fair Elections Now Act that's in Congress, like I said, which would incentivize politicians to seek small donations, which could level the playing field in American politics. Another thing they can do is find out more about these efforts to repeal Citizens United, either through the legislative process or through a constitutional amendment. One of the people that's been talking a lot about that is Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont. I would also encourage people to just keep track of the organizations that try to support getting money out of politics, whether it's an organization like Public Campaign or the Sunlight Foundation or the Center for Responsive Politics, which track this. There's a whole series of organizations out there, a Common Cause, for example, that does this kind of work. The unfortunate thing is they are underfunded and almost always outmatched by the corporate forces that funnel so much money into the political process. But I'd say that's something that people can do for starters.
And it's out there. I mean, a lot of people who say they feel powerless just haven't connected. They haven't connected with the right information, and they haven't connected with the people that are actually out there doing things. All right, Berman, I want to thank you for being on my show. If you want to read Ari's article, the 0.00000063% election, how the politics of the super rich became American politics, you can go to tomdispatch.com. And Ari Berman's book, published originally in 2010, is just out in paperback. You can go to herdingdonkeys.com. There'll also be a link to all of this on my site, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Ari Berman, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Thanks for having me.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, history has a way of just receding into the past, probably just by the nature of it being history, so quickly that it's hard to forget things that that had such prominence only a little while ago. I mean, think about things like the Tea Party, right? I mean, people go, oh, yeah, I remember them. But there's even Occupy. That's beginning to recede, although remnants, in fact, in the case of Occupy, strong remnants of it still remain. Well, one of the events of 2011 that brought much of this to the fore was what happened in Wisconsin. In early 2011, all of a sudden, we're looking at what's happening in Wisconsin's state capital in Madison. Unexpected occupation by union members and their allies. I think this is something we should not forget. There's a lot of lessons here, and I'm pleased to see a book from Monthly Review Press. It's called Wisconsin Uprising, Labor Fights Back. It's a series of essays, and it's edited by Michael D. Yates. It has a foreword by Robert W. McChesney. And Michael D. Yates is an associate editor of Monthly Review. You can go to monthlyreview.org. And he's also the editorial director of Monthly Review Press. Monthly Review is a journal as well. He's the author of the ABCs of the Economic Crisis, co-author, Why Unions Matter, and also I'd like almost to find out about this, Cheap Motels in a Hot Plate, among lots of other titles. We're reaching Michael Yates in Moab, Utah, wonderful place of the planet. Michael, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, thanks a lot. Glad to be here, Peter.
Well, here's a big leading easy question. Why should we be remembering Wisconsin? I mean, it's already receded into history. Why should we re-examine it in the manner that these essayists have?
Well, I think the main reason is that it was one of the very first labor uprisings after so many decades of attack upon working people in the United States, and it sort of segued right into the Occupy Wall Street movement. And as these things have, as the events that occurred in Wisconsin and in the OWS sort of seep into the activities and the mindsets of people, I think we can see a lot more uprisings in the future. So I think that's the main reason why it's important. It was a sign that labor was finally fighting back. And I think there are some lessons that we can take from that.
OWS being Occupy Wall Street.
Wall Street, yes.
Shorthand, it has become that. And I guess that's a testimony to the impact that it's had on the discourse we have about wealth and the power of wealth and how money, in many ways, rules so much of our life. So you, all of a sudden, you know, there's been austerity, there's been cutbacks, layoffs, and what have you. What precipitated, remind us of what precipitated this incredible outpouring, in fact, Wisconsin Uprising, Labor Fights Back, the name of your book, in early 2011?
Well, I think you can look at a couple of things. You can look at proximate and long-term causes. You know, the first and long-term cause is that there's been 30 years of austerity, 30 years of attacks on working people. There have been tremendous declines in, wages haven't increased and benefits have been cut and people are losing their pensions and it's on and on and on. And that was also true in Wisconsin. There have been a lot of private sector cutbacks in big businesses, meatpacking, engine production and so on in Milwaukee and other cities in Wisconsin. And that had been going on for a long time. And then you had the Great Recession, I guess we call it, that began in 2007. And it's still going on pretty much, although it was officially ended in 2009. And this has given rise to tremendous increases in the federal government's debt, and that allows the right to argue that we need more austerity. And finally, you know, as government aid to towns and cities and states diminished, you have states facing tremendous budget crises too. And that leads to the states calling for more and more austerity, more and more cutbacks, and public sector workers appear as the focal point of this. That is, it's argued by the right than Republicans and Democrats do, for that matter, that the wages of public sector workers, their benefits, their Cadillac health plans, etc., are the cause of this budget crisis, and therefore they have to be attacked to deal with the budget crisis. And when Scott Walker became governor of Wisconsin, and his aim became clear that he aimed not only to reduce the budget shortfall by reducing the pay and benefits of public sector workers, but he aimed to destroy their unions altogether. Well, then the long history of Wisconsin progressivism, I think, that was the first state in 1959 to have legislation that gave public sector workers the right to organize. Wisconsin is the home of unemployment compensation, workers' compensation, populist parties, farmer labor parties, etc. It all sort of came to a head, and that memory of the past, you know, dim as it might be, was sort of brought to a head, and beginning with teaching assistants at the University of Wisconsin, who were going to offer a Valentine's card to Governor Walker, saying that he broke their heart. And they took over the, you know, they said they weren't going to leave the state capitol, and it sort of spontaneously led to an uprising. And against that background, you have all the revolts occurring in the Middle East and so on. Finally, people around the world saying enough is enough, and you never know what kind of spark is going to set a fire, and this one set a fire in Wisconsin. And it led to days and days and days of mass protests and the occupation of the Capitol building. It just electrified the nation, so to speak, and it died out. We can talk about that, but I think that's what precipitated it. It was like a series of long-term, mid-term, short-term precipitators.
Well, Michael Yates,
finally gave rise to rebellion.
I want to get into some of these essays that appear in the book you've edited, Wisconsin Uprising, Labor Fights Back. It's a Monthly Review Press book. You can go to monthlyreview.org. And I'll have a link on my site as well, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. But in that excellent summary that you gave us, you mentioned about the layoffs and how the public sector workers had arisen as the scapegoat for the budget shortfalls that many states, in fact, locales, have had. Now, I mean, labor is always a big cost of any enterprise. So it's hard to, you know, the cars and the desks and everything else, the kind of the fixed capital, that always remains the same. But what can always be altered is what we pay labor. So the idea is, if Wisconsin or Michigan or Detroit, all of which have had budgetary problems, one of the ways that you can begin to attack budget shortfalls is to reduce how much you're paying labor. And if people have such a low minimum wage in this country, people say, well, wait a minute, these guys sweeping the floors, they're making $40,000 a year, and they got great health plans, and I get nothing. Well, let's knock them down a peg. What's wrong with that? I mean, you attribute it to the right, but one almost could say that it represents common sense. We don't have as much. Let's spend less. Where can we spend less? Labor.
Well, no, I think it's a typical, you know, divide and conquer strategy on the part of capital, on the part of the right, on the part of employers. But it does resonate with people, and that speaks to the question of the divisions within the labor movement, the labor movement's failures to, say, make the provision of public services to all a key feature of its own way of thinking, of its own propaganda, of its own education and educational materials. I mean, you really make a good point there. I used to teach auto workers in Pittsburgh, and nothing would get them more upset than to talk about teacher strikes in Pennsylvania, where they're legal, and the pay that teachers make and the low work that they do and so on and so forth. And
supposedly low work, yeah.
Right, and the public sector unions, because in the public sector the bargaining is with the state and it's political by nature, you know, you get a lot of backroom deals, you get a lot of political activity on the part of the unions that's not publicized and so on and so forth, and you can see how it would be easy to make these public sector workers scapegoats. So while it's a false scapegoating that many public sector workers make very little money, that other things equal, private sector workers make more money than public sector workers, you know, in the same kinds of jobs and the same kinds of training and the same kinds of schooling. Perhaps public sector workers have had a little bit better benefits than some private sector workers, So the scapegoating is false, first of all, but a part of the scapegoating works because the labor movement itself has failed in terms of its own activities, in terms of its attempt to build coalitions with the public for the provision of high-quality public services. You know, the public is in favor of good schooling for their kids. The public is in favor of Social Security. The public is in favor of good health benefits for everybody. But because the labor movement sometimes has taken a kind of a protect our members and the heck with everybody else sort of viewpoint, you can see how that scapegoating works. And what was neat about Wisconsin was it started to bring workers together, private sector workers. I mean, the public sector workers who were exempt from Walker's anti-collective bargaining stance, the firefighters and even some police, the firefighters especially. They said, wait a minute, we've had cutbacks too. We stand in solidarity with workers and private sector workers, you know, construction workers, iron workers, et cetera, flocking into Madison and saying, wait a minute, we have a lot in common with these people. And that was the real neat thing about Wisconsin. And what we hope, of course, is that will be built upon in the future to make a more inclusive kind of labor movement. Forgotten in the whole deal is that Wisconsin had a budget surplus. And Walker comes into power and immediately grants these major tax concessions to corporations and so on, and the budget shortfall disappears and becomes a deficit, and then they blame the public sector workers. So the whole notion that taxes were cut, that the wealthy don't pay their share of taxes, is lost in the shuffle, so to speak. And that's another thing that labor needs to be educating people about all the time.
The book is Wisconsin Uprising, Labor Fights Back. You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show. And just one other aspect, and you even touched on it, Michael Yates, and that is unions, some people see unions as only acting in behalf of their own members. So you have a labor elite. You have these well-paid sectors of the working class that is organized into unions. And full disclosure, I'm a member of the Broadcasters Union, so I have a deep interest in this. But I know, and this is talk about sort of off subject, but I know, for instance, there was just an Israeli general strike. One of the aspects of it was that they demanded, the Israeli unions were demanding higher wages for the non-union workers. So do non-union workers have a stake in the Wisconsin uprising, or is it just the labor elite that... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, first of all, a lot of non-union workers were in the rallies in Wisconsin and showed solidarity with working people. I think they saw that they had an interest in the protection of workers as a whole. And if you take away from the best paid sectors of the workforce and those with benefits, then it benefits the non-union workers not at all, because then there's not even a reason for employers to pay their non-union workers a little bit better in fear of unions. There's a threat effect, it's called, by economists, that when a large sector of the workforce is unionized, that non-union employers are threatened by the possibility of being unionized. So I think probably non-union workers did realize that. And it's not true that unions only support their own members. Unions are always in favor of better, you know, they have been in the forefront of efforts to provide better health care for everybody, raising the minimum wage and that sort of thing. So I think that Wisconsin also showed that there was solidarity between union and non-union workers, and non-union workers were looking at unions in a positive way, saying, wait a minute, they're spearheading this attack upon austerity that's going to affect all of us. Because you have to remember that, just like in a lot of states, and I'm sure Michigan is the same, it's not just that the governor or the state legislature wants to clamp down on public employees. They want to take away Medicare benefits, Medicaid benefits, or any state programs that aid the poor. There are attacks on public housing. There are, you know, demands on right-wing talk shows that people that receive public assistance have to be drug tested. So there are questions of immigrant workers who aren't in unions and so on and so forth. So it's not just that there's an attack on public sector workers. There's an attack on working people as a whole across the country. And what needs to be the case is that the union leadership and the union members start to see themselves as the sort of the vanguard or the protector of the working class as a whole. And that's what you hope will arise out of Wisconsin, because you saw a tremendous amount of solidarity there. You saw a tremendous amount of solidarity between private sector and public sector unionized workers, between unionized workers and non-unionized workers, sympathy for the unemployed. And that's occurred in Occupy Wall Street as well, where, you know, you had some of these occupies feeding homeless people and unemployed people, people that are marginalized, and so on. And that's what you need. You need a movement of all working people, whatever their station in life is. And that's the hope of the Wisconsin movement and the OWS movement that followed and all these uprisings around the world, that that kind of sort of working class perspective will begin to take hold. That's what we hope for.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Michael D. Yates. He's edited Wisconsin Uprising, Labor Fights Back, and it's a series of essays. And they're all interesting, and they all have into three parts. But one of the things that I frequently hear from people when I do like phone-in talk radio, or even people I talk to when I'm around, they say, "Well, yeah, that was great. Occupy Wall Street was great, and Wisconsin was great, and even there was a little reflection of that last year in Lansing, our state capital." But they say, "I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. I don't know how to hook up." How did these people, and I know the essays address this to somewhat, how all of a sudden did people that were completely unengaged in, sometimes even in their own unions, let alone in the political process or direct action, how did they suddenly transform themselves into this vibrant uprising, as echo the title of your book?
Well, I think that first of all, and you can't really predict this, that conditions in a society such as ours will always give rise to resistance, because let's face it, the basic nature of our economic system is such that the labor of working people supports the profit of the 1%, the incomes and the wealth of the 1%. I mean, everybody instinctively knows that, I think. When I teach people about that in classes, working people instinctively know that it's their labor that supports the whole society, and the inequality that there is comes on their back. So people have a general understanding of that, however distorted their viewpoints might be and however contradictory what they say they think will be. I think they know that. And so then you have something that occurs like in Wisconsin. It's kind of unpredictable, but you get a spark from the graduate students that occupy the Capitol building, and it starts to build. And finally, you see people standing up and saying, "Wait a minute, this isn't the kind of society we want in Wisconsin. We don't want a society where we have constant school cutbacks, where we have privatization of public services, where you don't get your garbage picked up, where the streets are unsafe, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." They want a better society. They have a good feeling for that. And so when you see people standing up for something that they believe in, then it attracts people. It's like the right wing attracts people because they stand for something, however horrible it might be. It's when you don't stand for anything that people say, "Well, what do you stand for? What are your principles?" So they're naturally attracted to this kind of thing. And then as they go, maybe just as observers, and they see this outpouring, they said, "This is the people's house, the state capitol building. This is our place." And people relate to that sort of thing because you know that the way the society is working, they don't act like it's our place, but we're saying it is our place. This is our principle. We want a better society. We want a different society. We want something not like what we have. We don't want to continue to suffer these cutbacks and cutbacks and cutbacks and reduction in public services. So then somebody maybe picks up a piece of literature, or somebody participates in a demonstration, and it's the action that begins to change people. It's participation in an uprising, participation in a strike, participation in some march or demonstration. That's what begins to change people's way of thinking. And from there, of course, hopefully you get, with the help of people that know about such things and they're experienced at organizing, a combination of leaders and people who start as followers and then hopefully become leaders themselves. You start to get a change in consciousness. And I guess that's the best way I can explain it. It's like when that fellow set himself on fire in Tunisia. It's such a dramatic event, and then people say, "Wait a minute, this is so horrible," and they start to demonstrate, and the police clamp down on them and smack their heads, and then they say, "Wait a minute, what's going on here? I've been wrong in the way I've been thinking. I better get active. I better do something." I think that's the kind of thing that begins to happen.
Michael Yates, one of the essays in your book is "A New American Workers' Movement Has Begun" by Dan Labatz. You think so? Is there been when we think of the workers' movement, we think of the 30s or the teens of the last century. Most of the unions, although they've been kind of many of them been dragged along. Some of them haven't even, you know, been sort of willful participants in this, but they still maintain a lot of the old features of bureaucracy and vested interest and things as they are. Do you think there is a new labor movement or workers' movement? I guess there's a difference between the labor movement and a workers' movement, I suppose. But
well, I think maybe what Dan is expressing is what there was an Italian. Writer named Antonio Gramsci, and he says that we have to have an optimism of the will, a pessimism of the intellect, an optimism of the will. Meaning,
okay.
The society is structured in such a way that you're bound to be a little bit pessimistic if you want sort of radical social change. I mean, in the United States, you're really up against it, but you have an optimism of your will. And indeed, the workers in Wisconsin said, enough's enough. The people in Occupy Wall Street said, enough's enough. We're tired of this inequality. We're tired of this. And then you see that Occupy Wall Street sort of intersect with the labor movement in New York City, especially in Oakland, where they shut down the docks. And there's a big dispute between the Dock Workers Union on the West Coast and a grain terminal in the state of Washington. And you know, by this intersection of struggles, people are given new hope and new optimism, an optimism of the will that there is a new labor movement in the offing. And I certainly hope that there is. I mean, I can't say for sure that there is. I mean, somebody told me, well, Michael's going to have egg on his face if after this book is published and nothing happens in the next year or two. But I don't think you can take that viewpoint. You have to assume that something is afoot. And there seems to be around the world something afoot. So many, you know, you see workers in China threatening suicide working in that plant that makes electronic components and what have you. That's just so dramatic. Or now in Egypt, you know, they're still revolting. Now, you know, the government hasn't implemented with the kind of things that the people wanted. You're going to see that kind of thing around the world, and it's going to be distorted and complicated, and all kinds of factions are going to form. But it looks like things are afoot.
You know,
we'll see now. The Occupy Wall Street people say there's going to be a big spring offensive and so on after they were kicked out of their places. And
yeah.
We'll see. There was a big May Day march in Wisconsin after the uprising there. A lot of immigrants participating, and we'll see what happens this May Day. And you have to think that things are percolating below the surface in labor unions. I mean, there's a long way to go, that's for sure.
I think they are, and there's talk of a May Day general strike in the United States, which I think may have a limited capacity to actually carry it out. But and also when the G8 and NATO meeting in Chicago. So this is going to be, I think, a hot summer. Michael Yates, you mentioned radical social change, and I was thinking essentially what we're talking about here is getting everybody a decent income, that we have city services that we can depend on, that we, and on like that, and health care. That doesn't sound like that should be radical social change. That seems like what a community ought to have as a matter of right, rather than we have to occupy this and have battles in the street with police. And you know what I'm saying?
I think that's the first step. I mean, it's a shame to think that that's radical social change in the United States, although it is. But the thing is I think large segments of the public in fact want those things too. They're contradictory. They might not want to pay for them.
Well, who couldn't want that? I mean, obviously.
No, I agree with you. People do want that, and that's why it sounds so insane that someone would say, let's eliminate Social Security, let's eliminate Medicare, let's not have public schools. That sounds insane to people. And so what's needed is a kind of movement that pushes for those things, that pushes for a sort of a conception of democracy that's a lot realer than the pathetic electoral system that we have in the United States, where you choose one of two people that basically have the same point of view overall, especially with respect to foreign policy and wars and things like that. I think that it is radical in the context of the United States, but since it's things that resonate with people, that's the first step. I think you have to fight for those matters of general public welfare. Of course, I think we have to think about other things too. I mean, I think about, like, in, you know, Detroit, the home of the auto industry, where I understand bicycles are making a comeback now.
Yep.
And you think about auto work. Now, the auto workers union was strong, but working in an auto factory is not a good thing. It's not something that you would aspire to spend the rest of your life doing. It's hard work. Even in the modern high-tech factories, they can put out a car every 45 seconds, and the kind of work that people do as the car is assembled along an assembly line is sort of body and soul destroying. And at least the auto workers made good pay, but now they don't. Now they get half as much. The new hires get half as much.
Yeah,
it's hard to imagine. I mean, we have to be thinking about not only the wages, but the kind of work that people do. Is that the best we can do as a society?
Michael, we
spend our life doing lousy jobs.
We are completely out of time. I was going to ask you one question, and that was, what do we do next? We have no time for it, but one of the first things we can do, the first thing to do is always to get informed. A model of resistance, nonviolent resistance, a desire for what should be ours as a community of people, is contained in the essays in Wisconsin Uprising, Labor Fights Back. It's edited by my guest, Michael D. Yates. It's a foreword by Robert W. McChesney. It's published by Monthly Review Press. You can go to monthlyreview.org, also to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Michael Yates, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
On the top.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
I want to hear more.
Everything.
More.
Then rocks.